So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time. Waiting for tonight. Oh.
Listen to Review Man.
He called me up on that Friday. He goes, well, I don't know, I want to stay. And I said, well, I go, why not? I said, well, I don't know if I'm happy doing this, you know. He said, they want to offer me everything I've ever wanted, but I don't know if that's more the reason. I said, okay, bro, I'm going to tell you a little story, and this is a true story. And this is the part where I know he's talked about this, so I'm okay with talking about this. But I said, in 1996 or whatever it was, when the Ramones were being inducted to the Hall of Fame, I'd heard about it, and I called up Johnny Ramone, and I said, congratulations. And he said, well, I don't think I'm going to go. I said, what do you mean you're not going to go? And I actually got really kind of upset. He's like, well, I think the whole thing's stupid and blah, 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 and that. God rest his soul. And I said, you have to go. And I kind of got angry, right? And he's like, well, why would I have to go? I don't have to do anything I don't want. He got kind of a little academic. And I said, because you're not doing this for just for the Ramones. You're doing this for punk rock. You're doing this because, like, you were the weird band that everybody said that sucked, that couldn't play their instrument, who inspired guys like me to pick up one, and everybody else, including the Sex Pistols, including the Clash, including pretty much every punk band in the world. You're the reason why this genre of music exists. If you don't show up, it's like spitting in people's faces. I said, finally, one of us got in and got recognized for something that we love, our culture, you know? Not that we needed to be recognized on that scale, you know what I mean? But just to be thought of as, like, not the weird, you know what I mean? For that moment, it's like, that's what you're doing it for, you know? It's like, punk rock was the real rock and roll. You invented this. You have to show up. He's like, okay, you're right. And he went. And I was like, I just told Johnny Ramone a piece of my mind, you know? Like, you know, that's how I'm looking at it. And I kind of told Punk that story. And hopefully, from what I understand, it kind of inspired him to kind of maybe get back on the horse a little bit.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting. And Wei, this might be a long one today.
I think it will be. Yep.
We are going to be chatting about the CM Punk Best in the World 3-disc DVD for the next however long this says on your listening device. And we've got a guest today, Wei.
Huge guest.
Colt Cabana is going to be joining us, a fellow podcaster from The Art of Wrestling and a good pal to CM Punk. His fan at Money in the Bank in the front row.
Okay, that's how they identified him.
And he is now on the WWE.com website, listed as one of CM Punk's friends.
Mm-hmm.
So not getting any love from WWE, but featured in the WWE Encyclopedia, no less, as Scotty Goldman during his brief SmackDown run.
The Encyclopedia, they published this?
Yeah, this was like a few years ago. They put out the Encyclopedia.
Of every participant ever.
Not everyone.
Well, who's missing?
There was no Crippler.
Right.
Yes. I'm sure there were omissions. I mean, when you think of every character that has been under WWE contract, I don't know if they fit everyone in. But they got Scotty Goldman,
mm-hmm.
who was just a couple of months he was up there on SmackDown. But Colt Cabana will be on our podcast for about as long as he was on SmackDown. So
40 minutes.
More than a cup of coffee, which is what I'm drinking here. And Wei, you are drinking water.
Well, I had my coffee for the day, John. I don't like to exceed more than one cup a day.
I do.
How many cups have you had?
Today, this would be 3.
Wow.
But it all depends on what you call a cup. Like, is this one cup of coffee for you?
That's like 2.
So that would
large.
That would increase it.
Why the need for more than one cup?
I feel whenever I felt this was going to be a long podcast, and I need a beverage of some sort to just have handy here.
So it's not.
This might be the most feedback we've ever gotten for a review.
Oh yeah, by far.
It's big.
a lot of buzz surrounding this DVD, especially with our community, and hopefully, it seems like a lot of people purchasing it, I would hope.
Yeah, I think so too. And we did get some questions from people of whether this podcast would spoil the CM Punk DVD if they have not seen it. Oh. And the short answer is
yes.
Yes, it is. Yeah. So if you are listening to this right now and you have not watched the Punk DVD and want to leave it a surprise of what is in store on the DVD, stop listening right now, because we are going to chat nonstop about this DVD for the next foreseeable future.
Yeah. And not to say that there's much to spoil here. This is a documentary. You guys know what happens.
Yeah, it's like, don't spoil his life story for me.
But
there's death at the end.
But you probably enjoy this much more if you had already seen it. Otherwise, you'd probably get lost anyway. So save this podcast for later. If you haven't watched the documentary yet, watch it, then listen to us.
We do have one of the few podcasts that is not doesn't date itself. I mean, you could listen to this 3 years from now as a just a small companion piece if you've watched the DVD.
Yeah.
And then you can get Colt Cabana's behind-the-scene thoughts of how he was able to get a meal out of this DVD.
These words will live forever.
They will. So let's dive right into things, Wei, because this was one of probably the most anticipated DVD of the year from the WWE. When it was first announced that CM Punk was going to be having his own DVD, it quickly was released the fact that CM Punk was going to be extremely hands-on with the production of this DVD. And I don't know if some guys always just kind of say that when they're promoting it, saying, I had a big hand in this. But watching this DVD, there certainly felt like a non-typical WWE influence to it. This felt like a very fresh approach to the WWE documentary, which, I mean, there have been some excellent ones in their history.
Yeah, there have. When was the last one you would think you really enjoyed?
Oh, there's been a few. I guess the Shawn Michaels Bret Hart one was completely different.
A documentary.
Yeah, it wasn't a documentary. I mean, the Randy Orton one wasn't too bad. I like that one. Certainly not at the level of this one. Chris Jericho had an excellent one. Again, he was very much a part of putting together the DVD. Edge had a really great one recently. Those are the ones that come to mind, at least over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. Any that stand out for you?
I don't remember which ones I've seen. I mean, maybe the World Class all the way back then was
World
was,
Class
was, that
was
one
really
that
good.
Saw.
There was also the non-WWE World Class DVD that Brian Harrison did, which is an excellent documentary as well, less known than the WWE version. In hindsight, obviously, this is weird, but the Benoit and Eddie ones were great. Mm-hmm. Those were the first two, I think, I saw with the WWE, where it was just they had all the video libraries to at least tell these guys stories. Yep. And they went out, they got AAA footage for Eddie, they got New Japan footage for Benoit, mm-hmm. and you could see that they went the extra mile to really tell these guys stories, in addition to the libraries of ECW and WCW they had acquired. And now the WWE owning so much of these libraries now, you can really tell the start to finish story of some of these guys' careers.
Mm-hmm. Although I would have to say, I feel like that generation of stars, their stories are already being told, or they already have been told here. And now with this DVD, the CM Punk DVD, we are seeing the first of a generation of wrestlers whose life story took place outside of WCW. This guy's career started pretty much at the end of the WCW and ECW, pretty much in a wrestling world monopolized by the WWF. And how would they tell that story? How would they show this guy's progression to where he is today without necessarily owning all that entire tape library?
When was the first time you had heard of CM Punk?
I didn't really start watching Ring of Honor until I started working here at the Fight Network. So
were cutting those shows, right? The Ring of Honor shows?
Yeah, back in 2005. Back, when
the first summer of Punk.
Right, yes. Back when ROH, I'd say, was at its height in terms of buzz and in terms of its roster. That was when Samoa Joe was in the middle of his two-year title reign. That's when Danielson was there. That's when Punk was there. Aries. That was just, there's just so much buzz about ROH at the time, and that's probably when I heard about this guy, CM Punk, who, didn't look like the most intimidating-looking wrestler. But once he opened his mouth, you could see why this guy was so special. And That's probably when. In fact, I remember you used to wear like a CM Punk shirt. Like
I did.
ROH CM Punk shirt.
I went to a Ring of Honor show. I first heard of Punk, I think it was 2002 when he did a few shots for NWA TNA on their Wednesday night pay-per-views, which I ordered almost every one of. So that was when I first saw him. And then it was just through the Wrestling Observer newsletter that I kept reading about CM Punk and Chris Hero in particular working at IWA Mid-South, and here these guys were in the small promotion doing like 90-minute matches, and it was like this big buzz at the time that here are these guys doing 90-minute matches, and this is really touched upon in the DVD, and that was my first kind of inkling about Punk. And then I went to my first Ring of Honor show. It was in New York back in the fall of 2003. I went with W.H. Park and another friend of ours, and we drove all the way. It was like 5 hours into New York State, and I decided to buy a T-shirt. And I bought it was straight edge in calligraphy with a CM Punk logo on it. And it was I just wanted to get a souvenir from my first Ring of Honor show back when I was like 19 years old. And that was maybe the last wrestling T-shirt I bought, to be honest with you.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe that was his first shirt, perhaps.
It might have been. Yeah. So that was when I first came. I'm amazed that you remember that.
You're not going to buy the yellow shirt? The GTS?
You know what? I don't mind the yellow T-shirt. Everyone's so down on yellow.
You could rock the yellow.
I mean, I question now my own fashion sense because I wear these T-shirts that are like, they are not too spectacular. These plain T-shirts. And one of them is yellow. And now I wonder if people look at me and say, God, that is the ugliest fucking thing ever.
Hmm.
And actually, as I think about it, that was not my last wrestling T-shirt I bought because I have the... No, I did not buy this, but I got a gift from Jason Agnew, a yellow Twin Towers shirt with Akeem and Big Boss Man that read Never Forget on it.
Very good.
So there
nice.
You go. That is our history of wrestling wardrobes.
Mm-hmm.
We will now dive into the DVD. And I guess, Wei, we start off... And he kind of talks about his family, and this was kind of the focus of the beginning portions, and stuff that I was not aware of that we learned, including his sister who was involved in that storyline, not his actual biological sister, but pretty much this family that essentially adopted him when, his father was an alcoholic, which he goes into, and pretty much completely cutting ties with his brother, like a big grudge he holds against his brother when they were involved in like a small backyard fed that was starting to grow, making some money. And it sounds like the brother just ripped everybody off and took all this money. And to this day, Punk does not talk to him. So some interesting stuff that myself, I was not aware of it regarding his family and pretty much putting this all out there in the opening portion of the DVD.
He is incredibly honest about all that stuff. And to me, it definitely still seems like he's holding a bit of a grudge towards certain people. I mean, he's certainly moved on, but he doesn't hide the fact that he doesn't get along with his family, and in fact, he treats his other adoptive family much, much closer, like his real siblings. Just kind of goes through his early days and how he always felt like an outcast in high school because he was into kind of nerdy things. And eventually he found acceptance through two things, punk rock and through professional wrestling. In fact, he cites Roddy Piper. Seeing Roddy Piper on TV, hey, here's this guy on TV in a skirt. He dresses weird. People don't like him. And then he shouts back at them. And hey, that's exactly like me. So a young kid in high school finding acceptance through these two things.
Yeah, and they had some great photos of him during his high school days where you could see that this guy was very much influenced by punk rock and the fact that he didn't fit in and he didn't try to kind of adapt his looks or whatever to, the popular groups in school or whatnot. But one thing throughout this DVD I found, and it's something that I think endears a lot of people to punk, is that you trust what this guy says. I mean, there's really this kind of honesty attached to punk that you just, a lot of wrestling DVDs I watch with kind of the, with that kind of bullshit factor of like, mm-hmm. Where is this guy trying to work you? And where is this guy? And believe me, I'm sure in every wrestler interview, you can find threads of, you know, lies in there. But with Punk, there just seems to be this honesty, this rapport he has built up upon his fan base, to which, much like when I've read, for instance, Chris Jericho's book, either of his books, when Edge wrote his book, those guys, to me, they're so honest mm-hmm. that you just... They've built up this credibility with their audience where it's not like a Hulk Hogan, for instance, where everything to me is taken with a grain of salt, whether he's telling the truth or not.
Yeah, yeah. And that goes back to the CM Punk character and persona on TV, and I think that's a big part of the reason why he connects so well with his audience, is because when he talks, you know he's being genuine. You know this is not him really playing a character. It's really him. What you see is what you get, and it just seems like that's kind of the ethic that this guy's lived his entire life by. And here in his DVD, why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't he be honest?
And we had a lot of different people interviewed for this documentary within WWE, and a lot of people outside of WWE, which I always find to be a great strength at times when you can get outside of the WWE bubble. To talk about guys with kind of testimonials, and as obviously Colt Cabana, very much a part of this. One of his original trainers, Ace Steel, was interviewed for this. A number of all three of the sisters that were part of this family that kind of adopted him were spoken to. And Lars Fredriksson from Rancid, who was one of the big surprises of this DVD. He was excellent throughout this.
Yeah, he was. I had no idea these two were so close. I'd seen him at the Hall of Fame this past year, sitting in the crowd next to Punk, but I had no idea they were such good friends. In fact, they pretty much describe each other's relationship as that of being brothers. And here, I didn't even know he was that big of a wrestling fan.
I, you know, had pretty much just seen as much as you had of this guy at the Hall of Fame, and sure, you know, probably a WWE fan, but it's always a bit of a shock when they go beyond just the WWE fan, and this guy is, like, into Japanese wrestling mm-hmm. and just independence he'll go check out and stuff, and Colt will chat about this more when we speak to him.
That's right. So, basically, the story progresses from when he starts discovering wrestling. He begins a backyard wrestling federation with his friends called the Lunatic Wrestling Federation, the LWF.
Was this kind of what the SMC was like?
Oh, they were way higher production than what we were. We didn't build a ring. We had some mattresses that we found on the side of the road and some.
Did you guys get people to come watch?
No, not really. Usually just whatever people were around at the park.
All right.
Yeah.
So yeah. This was a high-end backyard fed.
We certainly didn't get 900 to 1,000 people as what CM Punk was claiming that they did.
Yeah, that's a figure I am astonished by, if legitimate.
That's more than what Ring of Honor does.
That's what that is. Ring of Honor this past weekend just did over 900 people, and that was considered a great attendance figure.
So this was the LWF, and they quickly seemed to amass a reputation within the Chicago area as being those dangerous backyard wrestlers.
The Rebels.
The Rebels. In fact, they would attend the legitimate pro wrestling leagues in the area.
Featuring a young Justin Gabriel. No. Sorry, Justin Roberts.
Yes, yes. Did you catch the name of that? Of that Chicago Fed?
I don't think it was Steel Domain. That's where they eventually went to train at.
No, I don't think so either. Anyway, I don't even know if they really mentioned it on this DVD. But anyway, Justin Roberts was working for the legit indie wrestling Fed, and Punk and all the LWF guys would occasionally go to the show, heckle, and it seemed like
the assholes you would hate at a wrestling show.
Yeah. They had a reputation for being dangerous and rebellious because they weren't trained. But then Punk decides, what if I actually did get training? He was serious enough, and he went to Steel Domain with Ace Steel. And that's where he met one Colt Cabana.
Yep, that's where Cabana began. That's where Lita got her start. And Christopher Daniels worked out of there as well for a time. And their trainers were, Ace Steel, Danny Dominion, and Kevin Quinn. Those are names, maybe if you were like reading the... you know, PWI at the time, names you would see every now and then. And that was a big, those PWI magazines, that was a big influence for Punk and Cabana just to get out there and work all over the place just to get their names in magazines like that, and you'd get familiar with those names.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I found it interesting how the DVD kind of positions the two of them, Colt Cabana and CM Punk, and I think even Steele describes basically between the two, Cabana is the naturally athletic one. He's the one who grew up as an athlete all throughout high school, and Punk couldn't even really do a leapfrog, but his strength was always his promo ability, and that was certainly evident even in all this old footage of him just starting out in the business. He always seemed comfortable on that microphone.
Yeah, it's for some people, I find that speaking is just something that you really either have a knack for it or you don't. And certainly there are people that have grown into becoming great promos. But Punk seems like someone that just from day one just had this ability to project and be just such a hateable character.
Mm-hmm. He just had that confidence and it just seems so natural for him, and it's something that so many people try to work so hard at, and they never get to. But for somebody like CM Punk, it just seems like this is who he was, and this was what he was born to do.
And they do talk about the name, and it was, in fact, a girlfriend of his at the time.
This is a bonus. This is a bonus on the DVD.
Oh, right, where they talk about his name?
Yeah.
Or was that part in the documentary? I can't remember.
This All is right. a bonus, a little special feature about what CM stands for.
Chick Magnet Punk.
Chick Magnet, because he was in a tag team called the Chick Magnets.
Yes, and he had this name prior to meeting this girlfriend, Natalie, who then kind of encouraged him to go with the straight edge gimmick, because this wasn't a gimmick for the guy. He legitimately was straight edge at the time, and despite the lore out there that the man has never had a beer, he did once say in a shoot interview that he has drank beer before when he was like 14 or something, and it was after that that he never drank again.
I don't think that's surprising either, especially, you know, coming from what seems to be very affected by what his father his father's problems, and it's not surprising. Like, my dad smoked cigarettes, or he did smoke cigarettes, and like that, for that reason, I never want to go near one.
When did you find out that your dad smoked cigarettes? Because I was like 9, and I used to always get a ride to school with my mom, and then one day they switched it up, and my dad was going to drive me to school every morning, and we get into the car. And the first thing I noticed was that he had, like, this whole compartment of, like, Juicy Fruit gum. I was like, holy Christ, all this gum. And then he pulled out a cigar and started smoking one of those, like, they were actually called Colts. And he starts smoking. I'm like, holy shit, my dad smokes.
He smokes cigars, not even cigarettes?
Like, yeah, he didn't smoke cigarettes. He smoked cigars.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, man, I know this is not a cigarette, but nonetheless, smoking is not something you're to do. I'm like 8 years old here. It was and I told my dad, I'm like, Dad, should you be doing this? And he was like, it's okay. It's okay. Did you have a similar reaction?
You know, I always knew my dad smoked. It was just one of those things. Yeah.
It's a cigarette in the mouth while you were a baby, just smoking away?
Have you ever smoked? No, I haven't.
Really?
No.
Never.
You have?
I have literally smoked like 2 puffs of a cigarette when I was 13 years old. Freaked the fuck out of me.
How did you react? I'd like to know. Have I told you this story?
No,
set the scene for us. John Pollock's first cigarette.
Well, I was a victim of peer pressure. It was when all my friends started smoking. This was in elementary school, which is crazy.
Was this around the time when you were stealing candy bars and breaking Tamagotchis as well?
This would have predated that. This would have been grade 6 or 7. And a few of my friends started smoking. And then one day after school, they were like, hey, Pollock, why don't you try one? And it was like, this was like right out of one of those shitty PSAs. It's like, what should I do? And I was like, oh, I shouldn't smoke. They're like, oh, come on, come on, come on. I was like, I'm not going to look like a baby here. And I said, well, pass it over. And I tried it. And I don't even think I inhaled, to be honest. And I gave it back. And it was like I was training for cross-country running at the time. And I was like, man, this is going to really affect my running skills. And I went home, and I was just consumed with this guilt that, like, my parents would smell the smoke on my breath. And then I asked my mom, I was like, Mom, if you take a puff of a cigarette, could you get cancer? And I could tell she knew what I had done here. And I'll never forget. And she was like, well, John, once you smoke a cigarette, you've really opened the door for anything. And I was like, oh my God. And I got home and I went running for like an hour. I said I was going to exercise the smoke out of my lungs. And I never touched a cigarette after again. And to this day, I fucking detest the smell of cigarettes. I could never date someone that smokes cigarettes. I could not. It's just gross. I'm so happy that restaurants and bars in Toronto, you're not allowed to smoke. I don't understand cigarettes. But I imagine it's the exact same thing as me to coffee, that it doesn't give you a high or anything, but it's something that, whether it relaxes you or something that you just have an addictive personality that you gravitate towards and need that nicotine fix. But I just, I understand why people maybe smoke pot, but I don't get cigarettes. So if my kid were found to smoke cigarettes, my God.
You would give the same speech.
Orphanage. No, I'm kidding.
So this straight edge character.
Yeah, the straight edge character.
It just all seemed to start from who this guy actually was. And can you, like, there's no way a creative wrestling committee could ever come up with a character like this. It's based on a subgenre of a subgenre. And there's no way anybody would have been able to script any type of promo or be able to understand what I think this character ended up being.
Yeah, this is just an organic. I don't even like to use the word character because that's not what this was. It wasn't like you're playing this role, Phil Brooks. Become it. But it's much like.
It was an exaggeration.
Exactly. And it's you take one element. This is like an improv, kind of how you develop characters in improv, is that you endow someone with one characteristic. In this case, he's straight edge. And then you go, well, if that's true, what else could you assume is true about this character?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what CM Punk was. Okay, this guy is, he doesn't smoke or drink. We could make the logical assumption he feels that he is better than you. And this was just a character that was not a stretch for him. It's like, you, Wei, are a very unique individual, and everybody tells me that.
In what way?
Lots of people are like, Wei Ting, there's only one Wei Ting. I could not come up with you in my head. There's no way. There's no way.
Thank you, I guess. Is that supposed to be a compliment?
It's a huge compliment, Wei. You are very interesting. If you were to go into wrestling, you would draw. You would draw money.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, well, thank you.
So that is a CM Punk character. And then from there, we transition over to
IWA Mid-South.
IWA Mid-South, which they had, surprisingly, some very good footage of in terms of his matches with Cabana at the time, with Chris Hero.
Chris Hero, not Cassius Ohno.
Yeah, they called him Chris Hero in this, which is a hell of a interesting little fact.
They interview him as Chris Hero, key him as Chris Hero, and why wouldn't you? I mean, Cassius Ohno might not even be the gimmick that they want to bring him up as, but here to basically call him Chris Hero, to show all that footage, some really early footage of that feud that you mentioned. Have you seen any of these matches before between Hero and Punk?
I have seen a few because WH getting lots of praise on these podcasts this week. He used to buy tons of IWA Mid-South tapes. And he was someone that really, you know, it was the newsletters and WH that were kind of my pipeline at this time to kind of the independent scene, really. And he gave me a bunch of tapes, actually, which I still have, actually. I never gave them back to him as I think about this, yeah. But anyway, I had seen a bit of this at the time. I would actually like to go back and watch these. I know exactly where those tapes are, too. They're in my car, in my trunk.
They're in your car.
They're in my trunk. I don't have room anymore in my storage, and I've got to use my trunk now for a lot of stuff. So if you're going to break into a car, why would I say that? Why would I say that? I'm cutting this out. Because we go to wrestling shows sometimes in my car. But nonetheless, I had seen bits and pieces of this. And IWA Mid-South, this was Ian Rotten's group, just kind of your kind of small indie group, but they had some great talent and they were doing things that other indies were not doing, such as, you know, these 60-minute, 90-minute matches and getting a lot of praise. And this is really the power to me of the newsletters, is like, to me, Dave's newsletter put a lot of focus onto guys like this at the time, back in 2002 and 3, onto Ring of Honor. Like, where's Ring of Honor, Wei, if the Observer didn't cover it, for instance?
Yeah. You know, it without the Observer, without the internet, which a lot of the internet discussion is driven by what's reported in sites like the Observer's, I don't know. It's really, it's hard to think about. Maybe it would just be stuck somewhere between the tape traders.
That's what I always thought. The UWA here in Toronto, had it gotten the coverage that like an ROH would have gotten, I mean, you looked at the names on those, and it was every month we would go there to St. John's Hall, and it was like, How are we watching Ultimo Dragon and Jushin Thunder Liger here in Mississauga, Ontario, in a banquet hall?
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. Mm-hmm. And it just comes down to how many people are aware of it and kind of getting that that word out. But that's IWA Mid-South is a very interesting promotion at the time and tried a lot of weird shit.
A lot of time focused in this documentary on this feud between Chris Hero and CM Punk. And I thought, for them to focus on this, first of all, obviously a big portion of CM Punk's career, but I also thought a good tease for Chris Hero, one of their contracted wrestlers, to eventually make his appearance on WWE TV.
Yes, under a different name, though.
Yeah.
I don't mind the name change for Chris Hero.
Yeah, they're both just pretty goofy.
Like Chris Hero is, yeah. Cassius Ohno, I don't mind that as much. KO. Same gimmick. It's not that bad. I mean, I feel weird calling a man Cassius, but it's like Cassius Clay. So there you go.
Or Ohno.
This was also the part in where they interviewed Kurt Hawkins, who was just this mega fan at the time.
Yeah.
And they even had a photo of him with Punk, where Punk just looked so disinterested.
A photo that he carries with him in his cell phone.
Yeah, that's crazy.
This photo that Kurt Hawkins, a young Kurt Hawkins, took as a fan going to one of these shows. He went to one of these indie shows and
he was in like Long Island or somewhere.
He asked CM Punk for a photo, and I had no clue. I had no clue this guy was such a big fan, because he ended up getting signed to the WWE before CM Punk.
That's right. Did he?
Yeah, with the Edgeheads.
That was, well, Punk was in like 2005. And then Hawkins and Ryder, they weren't called up to the main. I don't know. It was probably around the same time.
But I had no clue this guy was such a big indie fan, and such a big fan of CM Punk in particular.
And this then led into the Ring of Honor chapter, and spent a lot more time than I thought they would on ROH.
Well, in fact, they went to the Ring of Honor Training Center to conduct this portion of the interviews with CM Punk.
Yeah, this was excellent. They featured his promo with Cabana by his side that he cut on Raven during their feud, which would have been around 2003.
Yeah.
And this was just a fantastic promo, and they were able to get footage from Ring of Honor, which I don't imagine was any kind of a problem.
You know, like, I mean, WWE has freely mentioned Ring of Honor on their TV many times, even like dating back to that Matt Hardy Edge feud. It's not of any concern for them whatsoever, and it's a real benefit to Ring of Honor for them to use this footage. So
I think they view Ring of Honor as just like
a feeder league.
Yeah, it really is.
Yep.
And I think the WWE has kind of come to that realization that this is a better industry because of the Ring of Honors.
Much like how they saw ECW in the 90s.
Yeah, and I think with TNA, they kind of view, well, they're on Spike TV, and they, by no means do I feel that they look at TNA as any kind of a threat. I mean, Samoa Joe, do you think that there was any problem with focusing on Samoa Joe in this? I doubt it.
I was surprised by that. I was surprised by that because, I mean, it's not like they show Hogan that often, or they show Flair that often.
They've mentioned, they were mentioning Hogan on TV when No Holds Barred DVD was coming out. I mean, they were mentioning Hogan in promos. I really don't
think they were making fun of him. That whole DVD release was to make fun of Hulk Hogan.
Well, you can also leave Hogan to himself to do that as well.
Here, they spent an entire section on that Joe versus Punk trilogy, really positioning Samoa Joe as a really big deal.
I would have actually liked to have heard from at least Raven here. Joe, maybe that you can make that happen. But with Raven, I would have really been interested to find kind of his side of it here, because this feud was really designed by Gabe at the time. It was like, you know, having Punk work with a veteran like Raven and kind of get inside his head to really kind of develop Punk psychology and stuff. And I think that this was really kind of a taking Raven's, you know, prior ECW spotlight and kind of focusing it on Punk kind of as this evolution of that character.
Right. I would have loved to have heard from Gabe.
Gabe would have been excellent on this. I agree.
Yeah. So Bryan Danielson obviously talks a lot here, adds his own insight into what they were building in Ring of Honor at the time. And like I said, a long portion of this spent on the Joe versus Punk trilogy, which, as a fan of that whole thing as it was happening, I was just so happy to see it on a WWE DVD, basically. You know, like it or not, these days, these DVDs do dictate the history of pro wrestling in a big way. And to see a feud like that, you know, immortalized on this documentary, I thought it was great. And I'm sure, you know, CM Punk had a big, big hand in telling everybody, hey, you got to include this, you got to put this in, this is a big part of my life.
Yeah, and I think this really helped tell the story. It's really tough to tell the CM Punk story without including Ring of Honor, and they did a very good job here, including, as we mentioned earlier, the very first Summer of Punk in 2005. And you've seen, Punk even acknowledges that he took a lot of what he was doing at that time and just did it in WWE to a new audience, whether it was the Snow Angels that he would do in the ring and the pipe bomb reference and stuff. You watch that Summer of Punk DVD. Ring of Honor just put out a whole DVD based on that summer at the time, and it's really interesting just to see how much carryover there was. And it was really interesting at the time because it got leaked, the fact that he had signed a WWE developmental deal, and Ring of Honor decided to use that to their advantage, that the news would get out. And here, instead of Punk kind of doing his swan song, he wins the title, and it really had fans like questioning what was going on here. It was something very unique.
He wins the title, and then he turns heel on the fans, just in the same match where they were, you know, crying tears, saying "Don't go, don't go." He cuts this promo where he just turns on the fans.
This was some of I thought Gabe's like finest work. Was that mid-2005 period? And you could tell, I would be curious if he was very much influenced. If you remember when the Dudley Boys signed with the WWF, on their last night, they win the tag titles and then lose them by the end of the night to Tommy Dreamer and Raven returning to ECW that night to win the titles with Dreamer. And it was just a cool way to kind of, we know the Dudleys are going out, but we're going to get one last swerve and kind of add some drama to them going out.
Yes, and I thought it was especially interesting with the CM Punk deal because so much of pro wrestling these days is the pro wrestling experience of being a fan is based around the internet and based around rumor sites, and you really, in many cases, have to use these rumors in order to shock people. In order to surprise people anymore, you got to take advantage and maybe leak inappropriate information that you're not really meaning. But it was, to me, one of the first instances where they were able to manipulate the internet to their advantage.
Mm-hmm. I always love the dichotomy of when there's – it's always you feel that there's this negative feeling towards the internet and what it's done to pro wrestling. But then on the other hand, when there's money to be made off of this audience, we will freely open ourselves to get them to open their wallets to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's very...
And as a fan, I enjoy it. I don't mind being worked from the internet. To me, I want to be able to suspend my disbelief. And doing it that way, I think, is just an evolution of what pro wrestling always has been.
They then move on to his time in Ohio Valley Wrestling, and pretty much they set this up that Punk went into OVW, didn't want to be there, felt that he was good enough to be on the main roster, and this is something, the same criticism came when Brian Danielson had to go to Florida, when Low-Key had to go to Florida, and it was that mindset that we don't care what you've done outside of this company, when you come in, we're going to break you down and teach you how to be a WWE superstar. And this, though, I'm sure this is a time period that at the time Punk must have hated, but looking in hindsight was probably very beneficial to him in terms of getting into the WWE system and, more importantly, working alongside Paul Heyman for close to a year.
Basically, Punk, and this is when Paul Heyman is introduced into this DVD.
This is when Heyman had been taken off of TV on SmackDown and moved down to OVW because Jim Cornette was let go in the summer of 05. They briefly had Tommy Dreamer in there, and then Heyman was inserted to be the new booker for OVW.
Heyman basically says he had always heard of the great work CM Punk was doing from his protege, Gabe Sapolsky, in ROH. And
you got a mention on the DVD.
Who did get a mention. And Heyman was basically salivating that he would be able to use this guy, CM Punk, in OVW, but he didn't get his hopes up because he always thought that he would just get called up. But then this guy just, this creative had nothing for him. And so CM Punk hated his time, but then he goes on to say that he took that time in OVW to learn as much about the pro wrestling TV production, how to edit the show, how to time out a show, and basically just working with Paul, he learned a lot in that year, and it ended up, I guess, being pretty beneficial.
And an interesting statistic here is that CM Punk was one of the last group of guys to come in that was able to keep his name.
Yes.
Can you imagine if he had had to... I mean, I think some of the better performers, I mean, a name change is not a killer, but You take away CM Punk.
Not more importantly, you take away that character.
Oh, yeah. They could have redone him. He could have been a fucking real estate agent.
Yes.
C mortgage person. I have nothing.
Okay.
Listen, yes. That's tough. That would be really tough. If this is the character you're going to play.
He could have been like maybe a very typical punk rocker. Should have come in with a mohawk and a guitar.
And his gimmick could be, or his finish could be the overdose. Because that's what a stereotypical rocker could have been would be to this company.
He could have been Heath Slater, this guy.
Oh, man. the one man punk rock band.
He could have been the one man band, yes.
2 megabytes.
But Punk attributes the whole reason that he was able to keep his name, keep his gimmick, basically the identity that he's been running with since his time back in the Indies, back in Chicago even, he attributes that to Paul Heyman. Paul Heyman started up ECW at the time, the WWE version of ECW, and just said, I want this guy. Don't change a thing about him. I want him as is.
And this was really where things got interesting, because now we were in the WWE system, and there was a lot of interesting stuff introduced at this point in the DVD, including quite the dismissal by John Cena of CM Punk. Basically, my guess would be...
the initial reaction of John Cena.
Yeah, reiterating what I'm sure a lot of them internally holding this disdain for the quote-unquote king of the indies, the CM Punks, the Daniel Bryans, where they would come in and Cena basically said there was no way he could live up to the hype, and he didn't. Mm-hmm. Just pretty much blanketed. You really, in the limited comments we got from Cena, not a fan of this guy.
I
would guess up until the past year or so.
Perhaps, but I wouldn't say he really came across that way. I mean, these were his initial reactions to CM Punk. And, put under that light that this guy had a match of the year, a 5-star match in the Wrestling Observer, and he's just on our show, and he looks like this. I could see the hype being
you look back to early 2011 when they had the title on Miz at the time, and Punk was really heating up as a heel at that point. And you have to imagine that as they're discussing WrestleMania, the idea of are we going to go with Miz or Punk is discussed at all. Cena, I guarantee you, had enough influence that he said, no, we're going with Miz.
Okay, well,
I really think a lot of people in that company didn't see anything in this guy till all the Money in the Bank stuff happened.
Yeah,
and then it was like this
absolutely.
Guy was completely rebranded in front of them.
Well, yes. I mean, Miz had a good year that year, too. You know, up
he was. That was at his peak. And believe me, at that point in time, I, too, was saying you stick with the Miz at this point, but you know what?
But in contrast, Punk was over on SmackDown. He was doing great work with the Straight Edge Society, but
then he had moved over to Raw at that point.
And
remember when he was Nexus?
And he was doing nothing. He was commentary because they had nothing for him. They put him on commentary. And
he was injured for a bit too.
Okay,
and then he came back with Nexus, and
But Nexus was not. It was already done. It was not a main.
It wasn't about Nexus though. But him as a character at that point, he was still, I would say. I would argue he was the top heel on Raw at the time.
Miz
was struggling at that point.
Yeah, but the Miz, you have to figure that they would plan that Miz-Cena match way in advance, even before December or January of that time. But anyway, we're
getting away from OVW time, and this is also when Michael Hayes is introduced.
Yes, Michael Hayes here, used very much as sort of the voice of the WWE brass. So Paul Heyman, for instance, would be the voice of the voice of the voiceless, and he would kind of argue, why isn't this guy hiring CM Punk yet? And here you would see interspersed between that clips of Michael Hayes kind of defending the viewpoint of the WWE at the time. In fact,
you know what? That was excellent because you needed that contrast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the great thing about a documentary is like you get to hear from many different sides. I think you're always going to get a slanted viewpoint in any piece of edited footage.
Sure.
But just to hear that kind of other side, you know what the other side was going through. Here, Michael Hayes basically outright says, the fact that somebody like Paul Heyman was so high on CM Punk, it made the company very wary of bringing this guy in because he's pretty honest about it. There's a clear distrust of whatever Paul Heyman says because they think that Paul Heyman is quick to exaggerate and maybe quick to overhype for his own influence.
Yeah, and I think that was good to have. Like, listen, Paul Heyman is certainly someone that is held in very high regard by a lot of people. But to simply say there are no negatives attached to this guy, I think you're somewhat putting your head in the sand as well. And there is a counter argument to some of the tactics that he has gone about as well. And that has certainly permeated a lot of the WWE front office. And that's basically brought up here. The fact that Heyman was so high on Punk hurt Punk in terms of it, in their eyes. Like, here's a guy who comes in with all this quote unquote internet buzz, and Paul Heyman is singing his praises. And it's a company that's, you know, has the mindset that we determine who are the stars, mm-hmm. and not the other way around. And it almost put CM Punk at a position where he now had to prove why he was worth the contract he was signed to.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy struggled when he was first called up, and there were people super behind this guy, and he had a lot of enemies at this time over that first year and a half.
It is so bizarre to me because somewhere along the way, some talent scout of yours found enough talent in this guy to sign him, yet that viewpoint doesn't travel all the way up. In fact, it's like you're introducing this guy into your system so he can struggle through and try to get to the top and try to prove himself to you another way. I just find it odd that you're the same people that somewhere along the way you wanted him. Now you're making him work. Now you're building everything against him to try to get him out. It's a very odd system of hiring.
Well, I mean, and later in the DVD, it even goes on where Vince McMahon is presenting, you know, I have this big challenge. I don't know if you can pull it off of being a heel. Like, what a disconnect from the talent that you are. It's clear that a lot of these guys, like, they have zero idea of what they're signing at mm-hmm. times. And yes, it goes through a number of levels. It's certainly not Vince McMahon that's going out offering these contracts, but you are the guy at the end of the day presenting these guys on television and trying to play to their strengths, not even aware of their tool set.
A big, big aspect of that particular story is that by that time, Vince said that Punk had already been champion twice. Punk was he'd been your world champion two times, and you don't know this guy's history.
If ever there was an argument that they look at that world title as a joke at times, and to me, that is what we're going to see later with Dolph Ziggler, is that you put a title on the guy hoping that that's going to get them over when they have no confidence behind this guy, and clearly that was the case for those two Punk title runs.
Yes. We're getting ahead of ourselves. So we go back to ECW now, the Paul Heyman WWF version of ECW. And Punk here introduced as really the star, the somebody who was supposed to be the star of this new generation of ECW.
And this was a big, I think, hook for ECW at the early parts. Was getting the first time we get to see Punk nationally. And this, to me, was the idea Heyman had for ECW, was that he would cater this promotion to what was hot at the time. And at this time, we're talking about June 2006. UFC was exploding. And I think his idea was that you'd have CM Punk, someone that very much can be marketed towards that audience and mm-hmm. presented in that light. You had Kurt Angle, someone who was banged up at the time. You could do short matches with him where he could get taps out of nowhere. And presenting ECW very much in that kind of work-shoot hybrid at the time. And Punk was a big part, I think, of his idea for ECW at the time.
And then Paul Heyman leaves.
Left. Yes. December to Dismember is covered. That is where Heyman wanted to put the title on Punk. They wanted Bobby Lashley. They won out. And the next day, Heyman was sent home, and Punk, for lack of a better term, was fucked.
He was now on his own, wading through this political minefield, as he calls it.
And this next year for Punk, it was challenging, to say the least. He was on that ECW brand. David Lagan, at this point, had been moved to ECW while Heyman was still there. I think he was around right at the onset of ECW. And afterwards, it was, I think, Bruce. No, it was Lagana and fuck. I want to say Ed Koski, but I'm drawing a blank right now on who else was kind of writing ECW at the time.
It's besides the point.
Anyway, it was a very much different ECW when Heyman was not there backing this guy. And Punk kind of inherited the term of being one of Heyman's guys at a point when this guy had just been flushed out of their system. And they go into
the feud with John Morrison,
which he buries.
He did.
Horrendous, he said. The matches were just horrendous, which they were not horrendous, as best as I can recall. I mean, they were eight-minute pay-per-view matches. It was not like something that, my God, how did this ever make it to air? But he was not happy with
it. And he was very critical of them even putting the title on John Morrison at the time. Just outright says this, not afraid to speak his mind on this DVD, saying he loves John Morrison, but he was just not ready. He felt like he was more ready at the time than John Morrison.
They did not dive into the whole situation where it was to be Punk and Benoit to determine the vacant ECW champion, and Benoit was to win that match. Mm. And when Benoit did not arrive, they went with Morrison, putting the title on Morrison. Morrison was not ready. I mean, not ready at all. But I guess they either figured they were not putting it on Punk regardless, or they felt Punk chasing was the money.
Mm. From then on,
not dived into on this DVD. No Benoit references.
Shocking.
Why? You know, I'm not going to say, obviously, of course they're not going to, but in the grand scheme of things, way.
Yeah.
If they were to talk about Benoit in this DVD, what criticism is there?
None.
This guy existed.
No, none from you or I or probably
anybody.
He was
a major mentor to Punk.
Yep. However, it's a very touchy subject. This is not just a company that that has our interests in mind. And by us, I mean you and I and all the people that listen to this podcast. They have the interests of their advertisers. They have, I don't know, the government now with Linda and all that.
I just don't see what the argument is of acknowledging something that every single person is aware of. Everyone, whether you are follow wrestling or you are in the news, knows Chris Benoit and what happened. And to simply say,
okay, the problem is that they don't want to be attributed as part of the cause of this guy's mental collapse.
I get that. I do get that. I just feel that it's to say the guy's name, it's almost like it's extended outside of wrestling. Like, we get people who will say, oh my God, they said Chris Benoit. Like, why would we not say Chris Benoit?
Mm-hmm.
This guy existed.
Yeah,
Charles Manson existed. Adolf Hitler was someone. It happened.
Yes, but Adolf Hitler wasn't under contract to you.
That is true. That is true. And he was not a WWE performer.
No, he was not.
Worst non-sequitur of the podcast brought to you by John Pollock.
What does his finisher be?
Yeah. Adolf Hitler's?
No, okay, let's not go there.
We would lose all fans and all our sponsors.
Anyway.
None of them. Wow, let's get us back on track. I like how you're leading this way. You're doing a great job quarterbacking.
I'm the one
going off on tangents, and you're keeping us on track here. I think you're looking at the clock here.
No, I'm not looking at the clock. I'm trying to progress because we got a big show coming up. We got Colt Cabana coming up.
Colt Cabana.
I'm sure loved our Adolf Hitler discussion.
Yeah. Jesus Christ, way. That's really tasteless.
But let's move on with this documentary because the reason we're spending so much time on it, it's a very good documentary, and it spurs a lot of discussion about this man's career in the company.
Yeah.
Really, the moment he enters the WWE, it is the story of a man who constantly has to battle uphill to get the recognition, to get, you know, not to sound cliche, but respect. That's this man's true story here in this WWE. He's working for people that, for whatever reason, doesn't see in him what so many people who are already fans of him see. And the first instance where maybe he gets a hint that maybe, hey, the company is starting to get behind me is when he wins the Money in the Bank at WrestleMania.
Yeah, that was in 2008, the first year he won Money in the Bank. And, of course, it was one where everyone was like, well, this guy's not going to win the title. Because the prior ones had been
Edge.
We had Edge in 2005. Rob Van Dam in 2006, it set up One Night Stand. And then 2007, it was Kennedy, which ended up going to Edge. All guys that people kind of accepted. And this was the first one where it was like, oh, Punk is not ready for the title. That's what a lot of people believed.
What had he done before that?
That was it. And at this point, he was not ECW champion, correct?
I don't know if they folded ECW by that time or not.
No, they had not, actually. I remember this pay-per-view. It was actually the ECW champion at this point was Kane, who won it on that show.
Okay.
Memory.
But you know, what were Punk's accomplishments up to that point?
Exactly. No one viewed that ECW title as any kind of a stepping stone. It was really almost the developmentally enhanced title at the time.
Right.
And Anyway, he wins the briefcase, and then it led to that Raw in the summer of 2008 where he runs out. Batista pretty much laid out Edge. Punk runs in, GTS to Edge, and pins him clean. And it was a very, very memorable moment on Raw of, at the time, you assume, wow, they're really going to get behind Punk. And then it really kind of played itself out that, yes, this guy's the champion. He's not going to be booked like the champion. John Cena and Batista had a feud that summer going into SummerSlam. They were positioned significantly higher. And Punk would have a feud with JBL.
Yes. And Michael Hayes here was really the voice of the company saying how...
I love this.
He basically, first of all, said a lot of people in the back didn't want Punk to have that title. A lot of people in the back thought that was a bad move to put this title on Punk at this time. And he also says that, you know, just he's honest in admitting that there were probably bigger feuds going on than what this guy was doing.
And he wasn't lying.
And he wasn't lying. Triple H, though, with perhaps one of the most memorable lines of this entire DVD. Triple H, the runner of this entire business, he says he believes that the title doesn't make the guy. The guy makes the title.
What? What? Because I see something very different on television.
Ryback, new champion. Hell in a Cell.
Oh, you know what? I'm more... If you were to tell me right now, Wei, that I'm going to run the WWE for the next month, and I get to pick one guy to put a title on, and my options are Ryback or Dolph Ziggler, I'm putting it on Ryback.
Okay. Why? You think he would make the title? Oh, why would you even have that choice? Why would you have to pick between either of them?
Well, those are... I mean, if you're throwing me those two options, number one would be keep it on Punk. But
yeah,
nonetheless,
okay.
We're getting way off.
So you're saying... Yeah, okay. We'll talk about this some other time.
But it was a very, very interesting statement from Triple H about how the title is viewed. And to me, he's completely right in that the idea of putting a title on a guy doesn't raise the guy up. Instead, your risk is if the guy's not, in the fans' eyes, at that level, you are turning the title, you are bringing the title down to that guy's level. Mm-hmm. And I thought that happened to a degree with Punk here, though something not mentioned here in this DVD is that when they put the title on Punk, as has happened quite a few times, it happened with Edge when they put it on for the first time. When you put the title on a new guy...
It happened on Hunter when he won the title the first time, in my opinion. He was the top guy in that company.
No, you're right. But I just mean in terms of people getting excited about someone new, someone fresh, numbers went up on Raw. They went up on the score here in Canada at the time, and people were interested in seeing something new. And I felt at the time you can attribute a lot of that to Punk because he was someone fresh at the time. And people wanted this guy, but he wasn't presented as that guy. And I think once people realized, they kind of divested themselves. But you're right about Hunter as well. Mm-hmm. That's fall of 99. He was not the top guy. It took that Foley feud to really cement him. Yes. And Punk didn't get that Foley feud back in 2008.
So from Punk's perspective, this just goes into the next chapter of his continued struggle against the company in that, hey, you gave me the title here. I'm supposed to be the man, yet I'm not being nearly treated like I should be. Eventually, we go to Unforgiven 2008, where he loses the title.
This was horrendous.
And I say loses...
He was attacked backstage
by the Legacy.
This is how Chuck Liddell lost his light heavyweight title, wasn't it?
I don't think so. No,
it didn't work like that.
He was attacked backstage by the Legacy, including Manu.
Manu.
Manu helped to into DiBiase.
Who quickly adopted the nickname online of Manure.
Yes. And Punk just, you know, discusses his disappointment with this. He wasn't even told, as he says, he wasn't even told about this happening until the day of. He had that match plan. He was excited to go and wrestle and wrestle that Elimination Chamber. And no, instead it was... was that the Elimination Chamber match?
It was... No, it was the Scramble match at Unforgiven.
Okay, right. And just so disappointed in that he lost.
Terrible. Like, just a terrible... Even worse than that is that they never even went back to Punk challenging Jericho for his title. They went right off to with Jericho and Michaels, and they didn't book Punk to go after Orton after this. It was so strange, just the way that...
Strange Punk, like this noise we're hearing.
Yeah, it was... There's nothing worse than a babyface, especially, being fucked, and then booked not to care.
Well, he did eventually get revenge, like, in 2011, 2012.
Oh, yeah. Remember they even brought up that video to show him?
At WrestleMania this year. That was the basis of this. of
long-term booking. 2.5 years in the making.
Just throughout this entire story, I was just so surprised that the WWE would allow themselves to be basically painted as the villains here. So often in their DVDs, the mandate is to exaggerate the righteousness of this company. Against WCW, they're the good guys. Against whoever, they're the good guys.
I think the WWE has a great grasp of when they know, when they have to play the heels, to what audience they're playing. If you go back to One Night Stand in 2005, they knew this audience wanted, they loved ECW and they wanted WWE to be the heels that night.
Mm-hmm.
And they, even, you know, when they have to tell the Steve Austin story about all the stupid ideas he was given prior to Stone Cold. I mean, this is a company they know, it's much like a match. They know when to sell.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how much involvement Vince actually has on this, on these DVDs, or if there's
I bet very little.
Yeah, I'm sure maybe it's just that DVD department. Whoever's working in there, they're doing an excellent job. They're doing some fantastic work here, and this is perhaps one of the best.
I think Michael Hayes completely understood his role, and it would not surprise me if he turned the dial up here, knowing this is a CM Punk DVD, and we're talking about how The Office had no interest in him, and you are The Office.
Yeah.
So yep. I mean,
I'm surprised Vince wasn't interviewed. Actually,
yeah, he wasn't spoken to in this. But you know what? That's also interesting too. That Vince and Stephanie, they were not going to play the role that they would be painted as in this.
So he wins the Money in the Bank again at WrestleMania 25, and this time he thought for sure he was going to be the first to lose the Money in the Bank and not win the title. But they put the title on him again, and this time Punk enthusiasm was understandably far less than what it was.
You also glossed over his legendary tag team with Kofi Kingston.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's how you respond from a world title loss, is you team with Kofi. Then he had that feud with Regal. One thing I missed earlier was when they were talking about his look and not looking like the typical WWE performer. And Jim Ross talked about, prior to that first Money in the Bank win, that he was almost on the cutting block. They were considering cutting this guy. Mm. And the story is that Shawn Michaels actually spoke up on Punk's behalf at a meeting one day.
Oh, the story. This wasn't told on in
No, this was not in the DVD, but Shawn Michaels was the guy. And I don't know if that goes back to the Survivor Series that was briefly shown here, where it was in Philadelphia, and Punk was paired with DX and somebody else in an elimination match, and the whole arena.
The Hardys.
Yeah. So there you have Jeff Hardy, Triple H, Shawn Michaels in the ring, and they're all chanting CM Punk. And I don't know if that was a moment that Shawn Michaels really was sold on the guy, but Michaels quietly had a huge role in this guy staying with the company. And we talk about his look, and back when the whole Benoit thing went down and Congress started investigating the WWE, they spoke to a number of Vince McMahon. Stephanie was also interviewed by Congress, and these transcripts made its way online. And I remember reading this, and they were asking them about, you know, wrestlers having a certain look, and she was trying to explain the diversity. She's like, yes, we have lots of attractive men. We also have a guy named CM Punk who looks horrible. And he's not a handsome man at all. And I can just picture CM Punk at home reading Congress documents of what Stephanie thinks of what an unattractive man he is. I always remember that. I was like, wow, this is what this company thinks of CM Punk. He looks like a dirtbag.
This is the woman that is in charge of creative. This is the woman who's writing all our storylines. Here is a very ugly man.
Yeah.
This is our definition of ugly here.
Anyway, I want to mention that story.
That's very funny.
But yes, 2009, he repeats as Money in the Bank winner, something nobody expected to have, a back-to-back Money in the Bank winner. And Punk, I think, was shocked as well.
And it is at this point where he has that meeting with Michael Hayes and Vince McMahon, where Vince McMahon lays down the challenge. What's the challenge?
We want you to be a heel, goddammit. I don't know if you can pull it off. And Punk responds, what's the challenge?
That's just ridiculous.
It's amazing.
Like, the draw of this guy's strength from the get-go is his ability to cut a heel promo. And the fact that the owner of your company, and Michael Hayes for that matter, the fact that they don't even know this about this guy, the fact that they made him run as a babyface for 3 years, I think is pretty outrageous.
I can't believe that in that whole time period, it's like, they never saw a clip on YouTube.
Yeah.
Believe me, I am sure there were people voicing, hey, we could be doing this with Punk, and it's just selective hearing.
Mm-hmm.
We'll digest it when we want to. And here in 2009, this was a big turning point for him. They turned him. He won the title, beating Jeff Hardy, where he capitalized after a match. And he won it as the babyface. And it was after this that they played up, you know, did he take advantage? And Punk, this was when he made that slow turn. And to me, the Jeff Hardy program was the turning point for this guy's career, because they gave him the mic and he got to get over as a heel on the mic, which was what this guy needed.
He just became himself the moment he had to started playing this role. He just seems so much more comfortable here as the dick.
And Jeff Hardy, I mean, this was the most popular this guy ever was in 2009, right before he took off. And I was amazed at the time they went to the degree they did. I mean, Punk really played up the straight edge character, contrasting that to Jeff Hardy, basically calling him a drug addict. Mm-hmm. And this was where Punk just, he took off. He was a fantastic promo. He then went into the feud with The Undertaker, where there were lots of stories at the time of Punk just getting heat with people for whatever reasons of, you know, what he wore to the arena and stuff like that. And it ended with The Undertaker beating him. And then Punk was just sent into obscurity to the point that he was world champion at the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view in October. And at the December pay-per-view, he worked a dark match against R-Truth. How someone could fall more, I don't know. I was stunned when I heard him bring that up, the fact that he worked a dark match. I had to look it up online. I was like, fuck, he was not lying.
The Miz. Could you imagine a Miz DVD talking about this whole year?
Yeah. Miz. The Mike Mizanin story.
There we go. Thank you, John. From that point on, Punk had nothing to do, and so it was up to him, really. They also get into a little section there where Punk talks about his reluctance to read anything scripted for him.
He would tear up promos in front of writers.
In front of writers, and you know, they get into that, which I'm sure to this day is how he likes to do things, because he doesn't really seem like he scripts anything out when he goes out there.
I remember on David Lagana's podcast, back when he was doing it, he told a story once of calling Punk on Christmas when he was still in ECW, and Lagana was writing ECW, and he just called to wish Punk a Merry Christmas. Punk said something to the degree of fuck off and hung up on him Christmas morning.
Oh,
what a guy. Oh. So this was when he was just in obscurity here going into 2010. Then he had that Rey Mysterio program, which really wasn't discussed at all in the DVD, but a great program, including that infamous promo with Rey's kids in the ring,
mm-hmm.
where it was just so great.
Yeah.
It was so great.
You're right. I was surprised they didn't include
I guess it was just a time thing. But then they did dive into the Straight Edge Society,
mm-hmm.
and this was taking Punk to another level. And his they had this awesome video package on the Straight Edge Society, which for those of you that have not seen the DVD or remember this was Punk with Luke Gallows, who had been reformed as Festus off the pills.
Festus was on drugs. That's why he was acting like that.
Then we also had Joey Mercury, and we had Serena Deeb. And what was it? Serena was her name on WWE,
yeah,
right?
Just Serena.
And
yep.
She shaved her head, mm-hmm. to join the Straight Edge Society. And Punk here, he says he wrote 14 weeks worth of TV and gave it to Vince, saying, this is what I'm doing for the next 14 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then says how a lot of the Straight Edge Society stuff, the office had no idea what I was doing. Was I trying to be a modern-day Jesus? Maybe. Was Luke Gallows and Joey Mercury my disciples? Maybe. Was Serena my Mary Magdalene? I don't know. This was great.
He said absolutely.
Yeah.
He confessed to that.
Yeah.
He basically confessed to being completely influenced by the Bible. And this was cool. What was not cool was this devil sequence. Do you remember this? Were they like...
Oh, yeah.
Just like... Punk and all the people were talking about how the fans started to react to this gimmick. Like, they were starting to call Punk the devil. And then all of a sudden, they edit in these voices. Devil, devil, devil. It was just so
I didn't mind
stupid.
It that much.
I thought it was so lame. This and like the previous section when they're just going through Straight Edge, they just like they're talking about, Lita's talking about what Straight Edge is, and they're putting everything in stencil font, big words on the screen, Straight Edge. It's putting this generic punk rock track. It's just like, wait, come on, this is not cool. This is not as cool as what these guys are talking about. It just sounds like so commercialized and lame. But anyway, Joey Mercury here tells a very, very heartwarming story about his relationship with CM Punk, about how when they were wrote on the road together, back when Mercury was back in Eminem in 2007, he was rooming with a guy who was straight edge despite himself being addicted to drugs. And he was eventually released, and his house was about to be closed. He was about to lose his house. And so a very touching moment when Joey Mercury here admits to perhaps a story that I don't think I've ever heard before. I don't know if you have, but
no.
It goes to show this guy, you know, does this thing and doesn't want anybody to know about it. CM Punk bought this man's house, and basically allowed him to continue his road to sobriety, which is an amazing story. Amazing that they, you know, did that and included this.
Yeah, and for those that are, you go back in history, and Joey Mercury, he was fired the Monday before WrestleMania in 2007, and was let go because of those drug issues, and then eventually came back here for this role. He now works behind the scenes for the WWE, and yeah, a story that I don't think anyone would have been aware of outside of those in that circle. So a very interesting story there from Joey Mercury.
The Straight Edge Society is then disbanded.
Yeah.
You remember that whole time?
I do, and I thought it was, well, first of all, Serena had a lot of problems and was let go, and then they disbanded the group. I thought it was way too early because they were really clicking, and they really emphasized that here on DVD. So after the Straight Edge Society, it was Punk, he had injured, it was his shoulder, I believe, and then he was put on commentary, then into Nexus, and this is where he kind of voices all his frustrations that had been building up. His contract was coming due. He was upset that he was facing Randy Orton at WrestleMania. He should have been facing Cena.
He was upset about The Miz being, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he pretty much just buries The Miz here.
And it's funny because Miz, throughout this documentary, is pretty much just praising Punk the entire time, saying how he's such a respected guy back in OVW, back in the locker room here.
And these are comments that Punk has said publicly before on numerous interviews, and said that, you know, he's told Miz this, but he doesn't care for how corporate he is, and just thinks that he's just a better performer than The Miz.
But Punk, at this point in his mind, he was done. He was ready to leave. He had accomplished whatever he wanted to. He wanted to quit.
And then, of course, this leads up to the big promo on June the 27th of last year in Las Vegas, Nevada, where they basically were going to incorporate his contract situation into the storyline, where it would be him against John Cena in Chicago at Money in the Bank, with the idea that he'd be leaving the company after that show. And that pretty much just give a bit of backstory to the promo. They came to Punk and said, hey, they're going to let you go for 5-6 minutes out there, and you just get to air your grievances.
That is amazing to me. It's still amazing to this day that they, I mean, we credit CM Punk a lot for that promo, of course, but we have to give credit to Vince, who allowed him to this free time on his network to be able to say all this stuff. You have to, this is a portion where I would have loved to have heard from Vince or from somebody backstage. Brian Gewirtz, to say why did you decide to do this even? And it's only been a year since it happened, so it's still very fresh on everybody's minds. That was like the first night the internet was just so abuzz.
It exploded.
We decided to do our first live review of Raw
that's true.
Of that reason, which we don't do anymore. Just too much trouble. But this promo, they air it in its entirety, which is fantastic. They didn't cut away at any point. They just showed it all. It was, for all intents and purposes, the climax of this story. Here's a guy who had been struggling against this authority for this entire time, and now he had enough, and here he is airing his grievances pent up from the past 6 years on their own show. And this promo just, at the time, I mean, it broke a ton of rules. I mean, he mentioned Hulk Hogan, mentioned the word wrestling.
Heyman, Lesnar.
Heyman.
Ring of Honor.
New Japan. John Laurinaitis. You know, like, these are things that
Laurinaitis was never acknowledged prior to this promo on television.
Colt Cabana. Like, these are things that at this point right now, I guess, 15 months removed, they're not a big deal whatsoever. But it just goes to show you how much this promo influenced this next year of storylines.
You know what I liked about this promo the most was that he didn't come out first and say, I'm not going to say what's on this piece of paper right now.
Yes.
So this was kind of the turning point, and then it leads into Money in the Bank, where at least the version of history they tell, we'll never probably know the exact facts, are that he came to the arena, and it wasn't until halfway through the show that he signed a new deal to stay with the company. And you can choose to believe that or not. It's a definitely more romantic version of the story, that here it was, the pay-per-view was midway through, and our main event performer that we were going to put the title on had not signed a deal.
That they just made a new shirt for, that they, did he debut a Cult of Personality that day, or was it
No, that's when he returned.
Time? Well, surely a deal was already made to have that song made and everything.
Yeah, so that was pretty much the complete turning point of his career, was that match, given 5 stars at the time, was just a pay-per-view that to this day I think people will always remember. Just the anticipation for that show. It was, to me, at the level of a WrestleMania, with everyone was so excited about this show.
Mm-hmm.
Just that atmosphere, being in Chicago. As much as people at the time were like, oh, they could save this for SummerSlam, you take that match out of Chicago,
oh, yeah,
it loses so much.
Absolutely.
And I still remember that time when they aired the video package and then they go to the arena shot and everyone gets up off their feet, mm-hmm, to just welcome Punk, and he comes out to just this monstrous reaction.
They did a good job of capturing that in this documentary too, basically letting that whole moment play out. And of course, the entire match is featured on the bonus disc. So, yeah, and that's about it about this DVD. That was,
yeah, they didn't really go past Money in the Bank. It was kind of, that is the, you know, the guy made it against, yep, all these problems and political issues. He made it,
compromised himself. You know, they didn't go into the next year where he would continue to be the champion and not be in any main event.
Lose to Triple H clean. Have a horrendous program with Kevin Nash.
Through a cell phone text.
Yeah, to me, it almost, you watch this, and it's like you watch this DVD, and it's, I mean, most times they do such a fantastic job on these DVDs that it's like, man, I feel like 10% of this guy comes across on television at times. Like, what an interesting, dynamic person this guy is. Forget just wrestler, just as a person. I mean, what an interesting guy here. And you question, like, what they could have done more after Money in the Bank versus what they did. And ultimately, you look right now, Punk is one of the top performers in the business right now. I just feel that at that time, for a short period of time, it was like Punk realistically did have the ability to just kick off something completely different in wrestling.
Yeah.
That I think expectations were so high because the WWE had done something so spectacular to set this in motion.
Absolutely. I mean, just thinking back to that time, how many non-wrestling fans were asking us? How many non-wrestling fans just took the time to look up YouTube to watch that promo? And I don't even think, like, the Steve Austin promo way back then even had half the impact that something like this had. And if they had capitalized on it, I wouldn't say that it would have turned business around that drastically, but it certainly, I really feel like they fumbled that whole time.
You also look, it's so interesting when you compare Austin and Punk, and with all the discussion of eventually doing a match with those two, it's that Austin really came up with this idea of, you know, attacking your boss, something, mm-hmm, that every fan would love to do. And it's almost like in today's society, you think of that, it's like, well, of course you could never attack your boss. But you know what? I think every disgruntled employee would love to cut that same 6-minute promo on their place of business.
Yes.
If you're a frustrated person. And it was so relatable, I'm sure, to a lot of people, that these are almost identical characters in the sense that they had these obstacles of an office in front of them. And
except with Punk, it just felt so much more real.
Yeah.
Steve Austin, it was a character, and it was done wonderfully, but this was an updated version of that for our generation. And it's a shame that their next program after this was Triple H, and then it was Kevin Nash. Yes, Laurinaitis became a big part of it, but it just became such a... It
became just a wrestling angle.
It didn't feel real anymore. And CM Punk is... He is the top heel at the moment, but it just... That realism is not there. The realism that was there at the night of this promo, it's hard to recapture.
So those were our thoughts on a fantastic DVD. We'll probably get a lot of DVD of the year selections from people at the end of the year.
Yep.
can't really say too much bad about this at all.
Yeah, it features two discs of a lot of matches. And, you know, I've heard some complaints about the lack of Ring of Honor matches. But come on, Ring of Honor, that's their business, is selling these DVDs.
And more to the point as well, like, those Joe matches were 60 minutes. Like, I don't yes. think they could have fit those on here.
Well, the thing is, a great compliment to this DVD set is are a bunch of Ring of Honor DVDs. They put out a Joe versus Punk trilogy DVD, complete with all three matches, plus a shoot interview. And like you said, the Summer of Punk DVD, I'm sure you could find those IWA Mid-South matches on another collection.
That's
as
the
well.
Thing. If you're such a big fan that you would want to say, go do yourself a favor, go mm-hmm. out and get this. Support Ring of Honor with a few bucks and go pick up that Summer of Punk DVD.
It's not even about being supportive. It's like, man, you want this for your collection. This is some like classic work of the past decade.
Yeah.
So, you know,
the matches are out there. It's not like these are relics in terms of when it comes to tapes and DVDs.
Yeah. This is just a great addition to any wrestling fan's DVD collection. Go out and get this. From what I heard, that first week when this was last week when it was released, you couldn't find this in most places.
I heard that from a few people. And it's a DVD that I think if you were to watch this documentary with a non-wrestling fan, they would have no problem following this and would probably be very much engaged with this guy CM Punk, whether mm-hmm. they'd heard of him or not after this. Completely relatable if you're not a wrestling fan. It's like a Beyond the Mat style of documentary where you do not need any prior knowledge going into this.
Mm-hmm.
Very relatable. All right. We are now going to go chat with Colt Cabana. You can always hear his Art of Wrestling podcast at welovecolt.com. And he sat down with myself and Wei Ting to chat about this DVD. All right. Well, we have just wrapped up chatting about the CM Punk Best in the World DVD. And one of the many highlights of that DVD was a man that I know all of our listeners know and love, the one and only Colt Boom Boom Cabana, here on the line all the way from Chicago in the Central Time Zone, joining us here in Toronto.
Gentlemen.
How's it going? Colt, how are you?
Gentlemen, it's going well. Fresh off of my new celebrity due to this DVD. And I'm ready. I'm ready to conquer the world now.
Well, you—I don't know if you're aware of this yet, Colt. Your face is plastered all over WWE.com now. Your picture is there. You are identified as a CM Punk with a bunch of his friends.
Hey, that's almost when I was known as a fan giving high fives when Jerry Lawler called that.
But this is evolution, Colt. You've gone from fan to friend.
Wow.
I think next time you're going to be CM Punk's brother, maybe identified on television.
I hope not, because he hates his brother.
That's true, and that's one of the many things we learned about in this DVD. Now, for people that have watched this, how far back did all the interviewing for this go on? Because we've been hearing about this project for almost a year now. When did they actually sit down with you to chat? And was this in the big Stamford, Connecticut Titan Towers?
No, I did mine WrestleMania weekend in, where was that? I don't even remember anymore. Miami?
Yeah, Miami.
Yeah.
We were there, Colt.
Oh, yeah, we did an interview there, too.
Yes, where I plugged you coming to Wrestle Reunion and then found out you'd be in Japan at Wrestle Reunion instead.
Well, that was, yeah, and I think I was in Japan when they were doing, when they did Chez and Ace and his sisters and his mom there. You know, so that's why they couldn't, because that's when they did everybody in Chicago, when he was in Chicago, but I think I was in Japan at that time, too. So, they wanted to make sure. Otherwise, I had no time to do it. And luckily, I had like an hour in between all my stuff at WrestleMania weekend. And I'm sorry, I had 4 hours because I literally sat down for 4 hours and talked.
That's how long the interview was. 4 hours.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like, something like that. We took a break in between and I made them order. I was like, it was at WWE's disposal. And, you know, like, I know they hate me or something. So I was like, you have to order me food and to pay my taxi over there. And they're like, okay. And I was like, sweet. It's a good life. The good perks of being under the WWE guys.
Wow. You've got to imagine of all these DVDs they've done, all the stuff that's just like that we never see. Like we heard about Punk and Austin doing like this 4-hour interview with Jim Ross. And then it's like you see it cut down so much. It's like you got to imagine all this stuff is stored somewhere where all these hours and hours of interviews they do. And then you just see, a portion of it in these finished DVDs.
Yeah, the main guy's name was Kieran that was doing everything. And I know he was editing everything together. I know he's been part of the company for a long time, too. And I can only imagine. I mean, he sat there for mine. He probably sat there for everybody else's. And I can only imagine just how much – I know you're thinking how much stuff there is, but all I can think about is how much that guy individually has to probably go through to piece everything together. It's got to be a lot of work for those guys.
So what was tell us a bit about just the interview process. I mean, were they all fairly familiar with your story and everything, and how did you enjoy the interview and spending 4 hours talking about one subject?
Well, I think what everyone was noting, at least my friends, is that I'm wearing like a Giordano's T-shirt, which is a pizza place in Chicago. Like, you know, at that point in my career and at this point in my career, like, I could care less about, like, WWE and stuff, you know? So, like, a lot of those guys will go in, or at least go into, like, WrestleMania Towers, like, all dressed up nice and whatever. And I was like, eh. And so that was, like, the nicest thing I had was a collared Giordano's T-shirt. So I wore that. And let's see. I don't know. You know, that was, like, more of my thing was I'm sick of – Not to make this like my story and from his story, but you know, I was just sick of any like in my head pressure of the WWE. So like I'm really free of all that, which is nice. And so in saying that, I could sit down and I literally just you know, I said whatever I wanted, and I told the stories I wanted to, and I told the stories about Punk. And he had like a long sheet, you know, which included tell me about IWA Mid-South. And when he said that, I was like, wow, that's so weird. That this guy is like, tell me about the feud between Chris Hero and CM Punk. And, you know, to hear this, you know, guy who's in this, you know, I know this world, but he shouldn't know anything about that, but apparently it was on his sheet. So he did. And so that was fun. A couple of those questions he asked, I was surprised that that's the material they were bringing up, but they did. So yeah, I mean, I don't know, sat down. Had some lunch, talked about Punk for 4 hours. And, you know, I remember some of the sound bites I said, and they used a lot of them that I said. Now that I watched it a second time at Punk's premiere, you know, I was in it a lot more than Ace was or something. So I don't know. You know, I don't know if I said the right things or they just liked me. I don't know.
What were your thoughts that first time, or even the second time now that you've seen the DVD twice? Were there any things, I'm curious, despite being the guy's best friend, were there any things about him that surprised you from this DVD?
No, I, you know, that's stuff all I know. I'll say this, I was surprised that he was, I'm totally biased, and I know a lot of people are saying that this is like one of the best interview documentaries and or maybe even, you know, DVDs they've put out. But it's hard for me because I think it's awesome because it's Punk. And, you know, this is something both of us have been waiting for 15 years. You know, not just him, like me too. You know, I this is something I've been waiting for him for so long. But for him to come out, especially that family stuff, to know that this is going to be your legacy almost, this documentary. And, you know, it'll be watched by millions. And for him to be like, yeah, I'm going to talk about it. And, I don't care. That was maybe a little surprising. I guess it, you know, nothing with Punk surprises me, but, for him to, you know, full out, be totally open and honest about everything. That was one thing. You know, one thing I had noticed about, and I talked about with Punk afterwards was, they needed a bad guy for the film, you know? So that's kind of what I thought. And I thought Michael Hayes kind of portrayed the man or the office or the bad guy. And I was wondering if he knew that he was going to be portrayed that way. And we both don't think he did. Like, he thought he was just telling the truth. But I think he comes out as the man, which is funny because Michael Hayes always known for not being the man, for being, you know, the free spirit outcast that he is. Has now, like, now represents corporate pro wrestling in America.
Mm-hmm. Another person that I like to know the reaction to DVD of is The Miz, who, you know, at one point he's very much complimentary of CM Punk, but then you hear CM Punk kind of be critical, in particular about him getting a WrestleMania main event ahead of CM Punk. Any idea what, you know, what was behind some of those reactions?
I know Punk has told him that before, so that's not like behind his back or anything, you know. And you know, I don't know. I wasn't there for those conversations, but I know Punk is like, "Here's why I'm pissed." I don't, you know, and it's and I, again, I can't. I wasn't there for it, but I know you know, that Miz has the utmost respect for Punk, and he was not that he was placed in it, but you know, he was chosen for that spot. It's not like Miz was going to be like, no, give it to Punk. I don't want to be headline of main event of WrestleMania. So that wasn't a shocker, I don't think, you know, whether he was going to say it on the DVD or not. But again, you know, Punk's been known to say whatever he wants. So I know that was a conversation they've had before, and that's a conversation I've heard or something I've heard from Punk's frustrations. And, you know, each week he'll come back to Chicago, and, you know, that's something that he just couldn't believe. And so, you know, that's just all part of the puzzle, I guess.
I just want to know a bit about as well, Colt, how long you yourself as well go back with Lars Fredriksson, because I think to a lot of fans, he was really just a surprise in the DVD. This guy was just excellent. And I know you guys watched WrestleMania this year together there in Miami as well. When did you guys all kind of meet?
Well, I met Mars. I met Mars. Mars Attacks. I met Lars, not this WrestleMania, the WrestleMania before. He had been friends with Punk forever, and I don't know if you guys know this. Lars is like and he says it on the DVD, but he's like a super huge indie. Like, he ordered from Smart Mark Video, like, in the early 2000s. You know, like, this is who Lars is. Just one of us, man. Like, he's been tape trading since, like, the 80s, you know? He's that super wrestling fan. He really is. And so, you know, it's not my cup of tea. I mean, Rancid's awesome, but that, you know, that kind of music isn't, I don't love it like Punk does. And so those two, you know, hooked up and became friends, and obviously the similarities between everything. And so finally, Lars was like, I'm going to go to WrestleMania. And Punk's like, yeah, of course. And so I was there too. So we were both his guests. And then obviously we became friends because, you know, wrestling brings that bond between us, together. So, I became friendly with Lars, and now, Lars was on the DVD. And I know that story. Did you see the one in the extras that he told? He actually tells the story of,
yeah, that was really the Ramon story, right?
Ramon story.
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah, which, you know, Joey alludes to in just the regular DVD, but you have to get the extras to hear the story. And, that's a cool thing about this DVD is the perspective from other people. It's not just, you know, Lars is, because of that, Lars is a big part of Punk's history, and because he's a friend and the same lifestyle and the same beliefs, and not only wrestling, but the punk rock, you know, lifestyle. So I thought it was important that he was in. And yeah, like, Lars, I assume he's a really big deal to you. Like, I know he's amazing at what he does, but you know, I'm a kid who likes, you know, Belle Biv DeVoe or whatever. So like, I wasn't really familiar with Rancid and his work. So I know this makes me sound stupid, but also maybe it's better for a friendship that, you know, I just know him for the person he is. I don't like, I'm not in awe of him because I'm really not familiar with his work as much as a lot of people are.
Well, was he kind of in awe of you when he met you, Colt?
No, I think he's met so many people. He, you know, I did help him. For those who remember it, 2 years at the Wrestle Reunion, I like helped him go around, get autographs and pictures with people like that didn't know him. And I'd be like, hey, Harley Race, this is my friend Lars. We take a picture. And he's like, oh, thanks, man. I really appreciate that. And so I would be his, like, I'd be like, just point who you want. I'll go hook it up. And then, like, you know, he's like, I'm like, hey, X-Pac, like, this is my friend Lars. And then, like, he's like, whoa, holy shit. And then X-Pac and Nash started, you know, going crazy for Lars. And I was like, okay, this one's taken care of.
It was funny. Earlier this week, me and Wei, a buddy of ours, just launched this book on kind of the history of Canadian punk rock. So they had this big launch party the other night, and they had, like, Arson was playing there, and they did a Q&A and stuff. And I ended up talking to a few of my friends there who are like, some are like really into wrestling and others just kind of casual. But then we started talking about the punk DVD, and then it turned to Lars Fredriksson, who all these guys are like, man, this guy is just, it became the whole talk of this conversation about how into pro wrestling this guy is. And it's one of the things I like about this DVD is that it crosses over much past just simply the pro wrestling fan that might pick this up. I mean, it's very much, it's a great story, which is what Punk kind of described it as, where whether you're a wrestling fan or not, it's really relatable whether you're into it or not.
Yeah, and it's because, but us as wrestling fans, we think it's a great story, but, you know, we're all biased to the wrestling. So
sure.
So it's important that, like, we, you know, we get that like acceptance from people who don't like wrestling that enjoy it. And, you know, I brought a bunch of my friends to the DVD premiere that, you know, I grew up with, and they were all like, man, what a story. And, they were really into it. So those are the opinions that I really like, are the ones that don't even like wrestling or don't even know anything about it, but can obviously, yeah, get into it. And so that's a credit to obviously Punk, but also the WWE staff and maybe the WWE staff for listening to Punk. But, you know, I know from trying to put my projects together that you can think of stuff, but you know, by the time you put pen to paper and you go to that MacBook and you have to put that thing together, it's hard work and it's hard to put your vision into an actual physical thing. And they really did it here.
No, I think the feedback has been so overwhelmingly positive. I think even Charles Schmidt enjoyed this DVD from this past Monday night. Maybe he's going to get a free copy of it. Tell us a bit about the screening from last week at the Portage Theater. 1,000 people showed up. It just seemed like it was just an awesome event, complete with milk and cookies.
Is that how the Canadians say Portage?
I think so. How do you? Well, we're reading it.
John's a unique Canadian.
Yeah, right. Portage.
Okay. It's our French up here that just permeates its way into our speak.
Of course, Chicagoans. It's Portage with a deep dish here. It was nice. It was really nice. The place was packed. It was supposed to be. They asked if I would introduce Punk. And Punk was like, no way, everybody, he's like, yeah, but like, let's get everybody up there. So, our friend Marty DeRosa, comedian, stand up, he introduced Lita, who introduced Cliff Compton, who introduced me, and then I introduced Punk. And, during the day, I think Marty, who's a stand up comedian, was like, man, you should show the chaperone as a joke beforehand. And they were like, oh my God, that's genius. So, I don't think he had the chaperone. For some reason, he had – what was the one he had, the other Triple H movie?
Oh, the one where – what was the other one he did? He did the chaperone, and then he did the follow-up, which is basically the exact same movie.
Inside Out?
That might be it.
Yeah, Inside Out. So we played Inside Out. It was perfect because, like, the first shot, it's like WWE Studios presents, and everyone's getting really excited. And it's and then, like, they show the logo, and then, like, Triple H's big forehead comes up, and then everyone's like, what?
So great.
Yeah, and then Punk gets on and he nixes it. And and so we all sat there and it was fun to watch. And we had to kind of like think about it because we were making wisecracks about it the whole time that people probably shouldn't hear. But then there was fans all over, like, and I know they were cracking up at the wisecracks we were all making. So, but that was a fun experience afterwards. Yeah, Punk in his best Andy Kaufman routine, you know, got everybody milk and cookies and I don't know. I mean, just to watch it on the giant screen was very, very cool. And like all the, you know, those are all the fans that you see, that I see at the independent shows and that I see, you know, when I go to the, you know, the Punk signing sometimes with him or whatever. And, it felt like I like it when it feels real casual because, you know, obviously Punk gets weirded out with fans when, and obviously you saw by the other night. And so, and I've seen him just get bombarded by people and it's usually the best when like, if everyone could just be cool and chill out and we could all just hang out, you know, that's when the situations get the best. And so that was like for 2.5 hours, we all just sat in seats and we all just like appreciated this DVD and it was like, we're all friends, you know, where it didn't have to be people pushing up to him and asking for pictures and again, weird. So, that was a really cool feeling. And it did. It felt like, you know, just a bunch of wrestling friends just hanging out watching a movie.
Did you feel that there were any inaccuracies about the DVD as you were watching it, at least from your own perspective?
No. I mean, I don't know how you could. I thought maybe if they wanted, I mean, they could have shown a million other things and you know, Punk and I will talk about that separately of, you know, like getting really deep into the independent stuff. But one thing I noticed quickly was they didn't really show his, how down he was in OVW. I remember that greatly, how, you know, I would just go down. I remember he was so down in the dumps. I once, you know, went down there for a week just to hang out with him to cheer him up a little bit. You know, it was in Louisville. That was 4 hours from me at the time. But he was really super down in his first match. Danny Inferno broke his nose and he was pretty sure that was a message sent towards him, you know, and he was down in the dumps for a while until eventually, you know, that call up. But that call up didn't happen for a year, and the whole time, yeah, he was doing good stuff with Heyman, but he was upset. And, you know, they didn't show that. But, again, there was so much they could have shown. It was hard to just go right into everything.
Were you surprised at the amount of acknowledgement they gave to Ring of Honor, going as far as to do a whole interview segment with Punk inside the ROH training center?
No, that was him directing. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, he took control of this thing, and he knew what he wanted. And he said, if you do my story, you do it right, or otherwise you don't do it. So that was a big part of his story, and I think it was important for him to have that stuff on there.
Do you think, Colt, when you see like a project like this put together, and it just seems that the WWE, at least philosophically, has at least made some strides. I mean, they look at performers like Punk and Bryan and guys that are coming up right now, and it seems that they're much more accepting now, it seems, of guys that have made it outside and kind of gotten over on their own before getting in. Or do you feel that there is still a giant leap that talent has to make once they come into the system, so to speak?
Yeah, I still think there's a giant leap. I just think these guys are so – I mean, you talk about Bryan and Punk, but, like, Bryan and Punk are so good that they just have – it'll just get there. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're – ridiculously good, and I watch Bryan on television now, and I'm just like, it's just, you know, we all knew it when he was doing his stuff, and it was so obvious that it could transfer, but like a lot of people just had that doubt for so many years because, you know, quote unquote, the corporation or the system will keep him down, keep him away, but they're so good they fought through all of it. And, you know, Punk's story is great, and Dragons will be great too when he has his DVD about how, you know, he'll probably be more diplomatic about it, but how he fought through the system and he got there. What I was most surprised about in terms of like DVD production and how things have changed, I was surprised that WWE would allow themselves to look like they did in that light in the DVD, because, you know, I said Michael Hayes came out as the corporate wrestling America or whatever, and he was kind of the bad guy. But at the end of the day, WWE was the bad guy because they kept on shitting on him and kept, you know, they gave him the title, but they wouldn't give him the run. You know, they made him look like he was this, that, and the next thing. And then eventually, you know, finally, you know, it's Punk who overcomes the demon known as WWE. But that surprises me that they would allow themselves to look in that light. But then at the end of the day, I think about it. Oh, but then they're also going to make millions of dollars off of this thing. So that's probably why they said, okay, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, they were able to weigh it out because they knew how much money they would make off of it.
When we said we were having you on the show, Colt, we got bombarded with questions here, and we've picked out a few here for you. The most predominant question was about Wrestling Road Diaries 2 and where things stand, this big road trip you did with Luke Gallows and Cliff Compton that everyone is looking forward to. Where is the documentary at right now?
Oh, well, listen, I appreciate everybody asking, and I get it, the questions every single day, and every day I just, you know, I say if I had the budget to pay the editor probably what he deserves, it would have been done 6 months ago. But unfortunately, this all comes out of my pocket. You know, I invested myself because the stock market and all that and the banks, they all suck, you know, like, so what little money I make from wrestling, I put it back into myself hoping to do well. And I've, you know, I'm paying this editor, you know, what I can. And he's putting it together. And so, I mean, he's just putting it together. I'm hoping before Christmas. That's my goal right now. But again, it's not on me. You know, it's kind of on the production staff, which is one guy. So, that's the best, you know, I really, of course, I want it out as badly as possible, because we had such a great time. And I know I've gained, just a different perspective from, wrestling fans from the first one, which, a lot of us, you know, knew me and Bryan from our independent days and our ROH stuff. So to see that movie, and now this is, I think, a whole different thing where these are kind of two guys that kind of gained like restardom due to my podcast and stuff. And so to see these three characters on the road, it's important for me to have this out. But, you know, with time, I do appreciate everybody wondering, though.
Tanise wanted to know if there is a particular match you've had with Punk that stands out in your entire career.
I mean, I could just sit here and talk about different ones. You know, in West St. Paul at the Armory for Steel Domain, I remember we, you know, Danny Dominion and Ace Steel, our trainers, would take us up there, and they were Kingfish up there, and we were like, we want to be Kingfish. And we did a series of matches up there that, like, really, like, I remember Danny coming back and being like, it's weird when you see your trainees outdoing your trainers. And, like, he even noticed that we were, this is what we were trying to do. And there was one particular match that was the best 2 out of 3 falls match. You know, you look at it now, it's shit. But back then, I think that's what got us into ROH. And, you know, that was something, you know, one night, IWC in Pittsburgh, Norm Connors had us do a best 2 out of 3 falls, but throughout the night. So we did 3 matches throughout the night. And it's like, those are memories you remember. Like, we changed outfits and we had all like 3 different matches and we still got paid like $20. And I remember in 3PW, Punk and I like being like, we're going to tear it up. And then we just had like the shittiest match at the ECW arena. And I think cause we were first time in the ECW arena, we wanted to have such a good match and, it was just awful. So, you know, there's so many of those. I wrestled Punk, and Eddie Guerrero in a 3-way and I had an asthma attack during the match. And like, that's something I'll never forget. Like, but for the wrong reasons, but it was awful.
We get this question from Alice, a female listener, who's curious if Colt has ever had someone refuse to do his podcast.
Low key.
Was that just, didn't want to do it out of character or just not interested?
No, he wanted to do it at first. And then I was like, hey, you want to do the podcast? He's like, I don't do interviews. I was like, all right.
That's strange. We've had plenty of those in our day. Actually, years and years ago, Brian Danielson once told me, he's like, well, if you're doing it out of character, that really takes all the fun out of pro wrestling. I'm like, oh, I can respect that, but, yeah, he was one guy that would not come on our show.
That's what I mean. But another, you know, I was known in the, like, I know there's a thing on me for like always keeping, you know, kayfabe or whatever during my interviews. But to me, it's ridiculous. Like, if you're gonna start talking about, if I'm in the Homicide feud and you're gonna start talking to me about like how fake the Homicide feud, you know, like it was just like what's the fucking point? So on my podcast, you know, I don't try to get into the stories of good and bad. I just, it's more of our, you know, like our struggles and I mean, you know that, but like it's less about, trying to the line of, you know, real or fake or whatever, or of storyline or angle. It's more about, you know, us as people trying to become pro wrestlers and trying to become famous or successful or whatnot.
And that's where I think everything has evolved to, Colt. It's like the days of, like, you know, doing your 5-6 minute hit on a radio station. It's just, I don't know where, what the value is in that at the end of the day. I'm much more someone that wants to hear something, you know, like an Art of Wrestling chat, where by the end of it, it's like, man, I really know this guy and have gotten a bit more in depth with who this guy is. Someone who a lot of people just, they've known the name for years, but you add a bit of context to who that guy is.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I agree. I'm luckily kind of doing all right now, but just to play your devil's advocate, like sometimes I'll see podcasts and they're an hour and a half long or 2 hours long and it'll be like, man, I just don't have the time to dedicate 2 hours to this thing that I'm not really sure of, where maybe if the radio was on, I could listen to it for 6 minutes. I'd be like, yeah, all right, that's 6. I'll take that.
Fair enough. Yeah. Fair enough.
Just obviously playing devil's advocate on you.
Listen, for my own namesake, I hope traditional radio does not die, because then I could be in trouble.
Right.
Another one here asking, if there's one big name you've, you know, a guest request that you could add that you haven't got yet, is there someone that really stands out?
There's a couple that have, like, that I won't give away right now because they've said yes, and I'm really excited about them doing it. So in terms of that. But obviously, you know, Punk was alluding to trying to get Cena on the program, and it's not, I could, and, I don't know, maybe for like 200 or something, you know, episode 200 or something, but, I'm not running to get John Cena right now because I don't know. It's so, for some reasons I find other people's story a little more fascinating. I always, because I'm a guy who hasn't gotten to where I want to get yet, I always side with the people who are maybe struggling a little more than uber successful. But at the same time, you know, I know what I like about a guy like John Cena, what I'd like to talk to him about is, you know, why he's normal and why and what his failures have been. You know, this didn't happen with me, but when Johnny Curtis sat down with like, we all had our meetings with Vince McMahon a couple years ago, and like Johnny Curtis was like, my meeting was just, I don't know, it was pretty bad, but Johnny Curtis was saying how like Vince really opened up to him and was like, I've failed in every aspect of everything I've ever done. You know, this wrestling was the first thing, and he was telling him all the jobs that he had that went under and he was unsuccessful at. And like, that to me is the most interesting thing to hear about, obviously XFL, but like used car lots and just other stuff that he tried to do before, like, he took over his father's business. That's to me, that's really interesting. So in turning that back to Cena, you know, like, I want to know what makes him normal, what makes him a human being, you know, his failures in life.
Do you see one of the listeners wants to know, do you see your podcast being taken to another medium, perhaps like the Ricky Gervais podcast being produced for HBO right now? How far do you think The Art of Wrestling will be able to go?
So obviously we're doing Mike Timpson draws some of those cartoons. If you guys haven't seen that.
They're excellent. Yeah. I have seen them. They're great.
And so, like, yeah, like, in real life, I mean, this whole thing was done so it could get to a bigger platform, if that makes sense. Like, you know, I started, I don't know, like, in my, and here's what I've been on the guys lately is, like, my goal now is to try to get, like, $5 wrestling on Adult Swim or something to do with IFC, you know, is to try to, break through the barriers of, you know, just wrestling is only allowed on USA. And like what I like and what I indulge in isn't just normal pyro and wrestling. It's just the weird, wacky world of wrestling, which I think can cross over if done right. And I know we're in our own niche and our own bubble, but, you know, I try, like, even small steps, like I'd love, you know, I've reached out a couple times and I'll keep trying is to do something with the Fight Network is produce, you know, like I think I can produce good wrestling material that's different and along with Marty and, you know, I've got all these like, I'm gathering all these, you know, great people by my side. You know, I think Cliff Compton is available to put out entertaining stuff with me. And like my goal is to just produce stuff and we are, and like now I'm doing audio, riff tracks, you know, for wrestling movies. And I have this digital store and I'm going to do stuff with that. But this is all to grow to one day try to, like, you know, get on TV or do something. You know, I don't know the plan right away, but it's meant to all grow and get bigger and bigger and bigger. And I don't want to just be stagnant. Like, I want this thing to grow as high as I can because I've realized that, it can't be sitting here and hoping WWE, and I've said this a million times, like, that, like, they see, you know, that WWE's like, oh, look what Colt's doing, because they won't, because they, those top dogs have no clue, you know? So it's gotta be about growing my own thing and making it huge and, like, bringing everybody on board that other people said no to. So that's important to me. And, what's great is I know I'm old in terms of the wrestling world, 32, but in terms of the business world, you know, I'm young. So if I could put them all together, that's, you know, I got a lot of years ahead of me, I think.
Were you bombarded after the Ohio Comic Con when CM Punk just dropped that that little nugget?
Yeah, right. yeah, and I got a couple of weird emails of just like, I do interviews, tell me this. And it's like, ugh, stop it. That's not how you interview people. yeah, you know, and I said this to somebody else, it's just like, it's so, to me, it's the smart money is on making that happen, right? It's kind of obvious. I like to think, but you know, I'm my own person, so I'm my own biggest cheerleader, but we'd say that's the smart answer, but we know that company sometimes doesn't do the smartest things. So, unfortunately, you know, I know he's crossing his fingers, but I can't wait around forever for anything like that, so I have to do my own stuff, you know?
Is it kind of like cut and dry, Colt? Like, if they came to you, would you jump at that offer? I'm like, obviously it would depend on what the terms of the offer were, but I mean, you've just created just this entire network for yourself that As someone that consumes your stuff, I mean, it would suck to see it all kind of disappear for, you know, a run that you don't even know what could happen with. Obviously, you know what your situation is like, but it's like you've created something incredible outside of the machine.
Yeah, and I'm like this girl looking for attention, just like I want them to love me, but they, like, her daddy hates whatever, it's banned by her daddy, like, I feel like that, and I've said, like, I do, a lot of it I do out of spite, just because it's like they told me that I'm not allowed to be part of, you know, wrestling, you know, basically they said that to me, and I'm like, fuck you, I am part of wrestling, you just watch, you'll love me then, but it's not cut and dry because I've came to the point in my life where I'm like, I wouldn't move to Florida. You know what I'm saying? Like, I wouldn't just drop the stuff that I do at the drop of a hat. But if they were smart, they and it's sometimes, John, it's not about wrestling almost. Like, I just think I could do so much fun stuff, like what I'm doing with the people that I'm doing now, just on a bigger level. And, I don't know. You know, it's not cut and dry. It's very wishy-washy and, like, I just dream of the stuff that I could do with their supplies and all the stuff they have at their hands and the editors they have and, like, the editors that are friends of mine that, like, there's so many people when I go to the WWE shows, like, from .com and stuff that, like, that are such fans of mine, you know, that work for that company behind the scenes. And it's like I knew if I went and did some stuff there, like, we could all really do some really great stuff. That's my thoughts, is just doing awesome stuff like at .com or just little shorts and little digitals and just different ways to get people over. But, that's, everybody does that, you know, I'm sure you think the same thing. So, that's just, I don't know. So, I mean, for now I'll do my stuff and the podcast is obviously my baby and I think that would be part of the deal. If I was to ever go back, is that I don't want to drop that, and I don't think that'd be a problem.
And I think, if you're WWE, it's almost like a resource. I think there's a lot of fans that have probably learned a whole hell of a lot more about Johnny Curtis on your podcast than anything that they saw on NXT, for instance. I mean, I think that it's something that could be a really valuable tool that the WWE hasn't really done internally with them, especially with talent at that level.
Well, we know that, but they don't know that, you know?
I'll give them a few years. Give them a few years. We just have a few more questions here, and then we'll wrap things up here, Colt. But this one comes from all the way from Sergey in Russia, who says, Colt, any plans on touring Russia? Generico did pretty good here.
I know. And so did Sanjay and M-Dog. They get those crazy tours, you know? I don't know. Obviously, Sergey speaks English, but sometimes I feel that, like, you know, my podcast is what kind of promotes me, and that's what I have going for me, and that's kind of my tool right now. And, that doesn't really – I mean, it's out there. You can get that in iTunes, but if you don't speak English, you can't listen to it. So, that's why those guys are doing – Sanjay is in TNA, and so they know him from there. But I'm not getting a lot of these random tours that a lot of guys get. I did go to Chile and I got to go. Where did I go?
Newfoundland. Weren't you just recently in Newfoundland?
Yeah, Newfoundland. But the Newfies speak English. You know what I'm saying? So
barely, but they try.
Yeah, the places where they speak English, like I get to go to, and I'm gonna go to Hawaii now. But I don't get to go to these random, bizarre, obscure places that like only Generico and Joe Legend go to. But I'd love to come to Russia. That sounds amazing.
Shane wanted to know, you're known for a very distinct style of wrestling, Colt. Has there ever been a time when your style hasn't gone over too well with an audience, and how did you react or overcome it?
This is something I've talked about with other people, and I'll talk about it with some comedian friends too, is like, because, right, I do very, I have a wacky, different comedic-based style, and what's fun is I have bombed comedically in the ring, but if my jokes bomb in the ring, I can just go back to wrestling, you know, like I have that, it's on the marquee. Like the people won't start booing or heckling. They'll just watch the wrestling part of it, which I know how to do very well, you know, whereas comedians, if their jokes bomb, you know, they have nothing. They're supposed to go back on their comedy. So, it has happened, but I just start wrestling purely. And I ditch some of the more comedic aspect of it. But also they say in wrestling to know your audience, and sometimes I know which audiences want to see the fun-loving, goofy stuff, and other times I'll know that this, you know, I need the time to get like a relationship with this crowd, and I don't have the time, and it's too big, and I'll just wrestle a normal match. I mean, that happens all the time. That happened, you know, a lot in Japan. You know, I tried to put as much comedy in Japan, but sometimes you could see they just wanted the wrestling, and I knew just give them straight up wrestling. So it's really about knowing your audience.
Are you still doing any improv stuff in Chicago right now, Colt?
I mean, we did a show the other night to help the Sam Thompson Memorial
Fund, right?
And we did the show that I was doing a couple summers ago, where I'd go up and I'd tell stories, and then the improv players would do improv comedy. So what happened was I was taking classes and I was doing shows, but as I got more popular with the podcast and just the viral stuff, next thing you know, I couldn't do Sundays anymore because I had shows, or I had stuff on Wednesday, or I was flying out different places. And it really, because what I thought was happening was I got fired from WWE, and then I tried to morph maybe a little more into comedy because I figured the wrestling wouldn't be as successful, but then the wrestling got really successful. So I had to go back into the wrestling a lot more, which is obviously my passion. So right now, I was doing improv and I was doing stand-up with Mick, and obviously Mick's doing really well. And what I was trying to do was find my comedic/wrestling bug or love. And I've really seemed to found it in the stand-up and writing the Creative Has Nothing For You's, and also the live – did I say stand-up? I meant podcast. Sorry. The podcast, writing the Creative Has Nothing For You's, performing the Creative Has Nothing For You's, and also the live podcasting. And so, like, I was the host and Punk told stories, but, you know – the freedom and the improv to interject myself in the middle of those stories and talk with him and get those laughs too, really, that's what I really enjoy. So I really enjoy doing live podcasting. My fear is that the crowd, there won't be a big crowd, but I have to get over that fear and just do them. So, this is something that we've been throwing around, but I guess as a reveal on your show, is I think I'm going to do like either a 4 or 5 city kind of East Coast tour of just the podcast.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, hopefully, tape all the podcasts and hopefully film it for another documentary, but less the documentary and more just the idea of just traveling the podcast around, as opposed to just a wrestling show. And my big thing is always you need a 5,000 pound wrestling ring to do a wrestling show. And I always wanted to try to find my way around that. So, maybe this is an answer to it, you know.
Nick Houseman, who he used to be with Resistance Pro, he wants one day the three of us to all do an improv show together, a wrestling based improv show.
I'm sure he does.
Would you be down, Colt?
We'll see.
That's a no. Last question comes from Chris in Ottawa, who asks some of your influences coming into wrestling, and his last question was someone that you got into the business not really being a big fan of, but someone who, as you became a more seasoned performer, you grew to appreciate their style. Does anyone come to mind of someone that you kind of understood more as you became a professional?
Oh, I think, well, first of all, I think everybody, because of when you learn how much this hurts and the daily toll, those Memphis guys, all those Memphis guys that would wrestle 7-8 days a week, you learn to highly appreciate those guys. And, as a fan, sometimes you think, God, they're sitting on their butt doing nothing. But you got to realize that, if you're watching that 1970s tape from the Louisville Gardens or whatever, like that's day, 95 of 93 matches or something. You know what I'm saying? So you really learn to appreciate the toll that this takes on your body. But in saying that, also I always say Les Kellett and Cat Weasel, is these are guys I didn't even know going into wrestling, and then once I learned about wrestling, and then once I saw them, I don't know if I'd have the same appreciation I did for if I was not in the world of wrestling, if I was just a fan. And I don't know. The outgoing guys, I don't know, yeah, I don't know. That's all I got. I mean, because I was, at the end of the day, I was such a super wrestling fan of everybody when I wasn't in wrestling. Like, I just thought because they were wrestlers, they were cooler than me and they were awesome. Like, I just loved all, everybody that was a wrestler because they were wrestlers. So that's kind of where I stood before getting into wrestling.
All right. Well, that that wraps up our questions. So thanks to the listeners that sent those in. And Colt, thank you very much for this this extended period of your busy schedule here. And let's let listeners know where they can go for more Colt Cabana, because I know you have tons of stuff on the go. I guess your best starting point is welovecolt.com.
Yeah, everything goes from there. I did just I started this new thing. It's called digitalcolt.com. And it's digital downloads, and I'm going to try to get the Road Diaries on there as a download, because I know a lot of people just want the MP4 of it. But yeah, Marty and I have started $5 Wrestling Movies. We did the audio track for No Holds Barred, and I think we're going to do one a month. Yeah, it's only a $1.99. So, I mean, you know, less than a, or you know, just as much as a pack of gum or whatever. So. But I know it's hard because sometimes I stop myself from, you got to push like PayPal and that deters people, but it's only $2. But, yeah, that's something new we're trying, and we're going to try some other stuff. I think some $5 YouTube stuff might be on the horizon. And, you know, my website, you know, I have the movie and, Creative Is Nothing For You. But at the end of the day, you know, I'm total DIY. I'm trying to just keep afloat. The best way anybody can support is my merchandise, coltmerch.com. And, you know, if you think it's cool that I'm on WWE DVDs and, I have no contract and I'm trying to do this myself, you know, you can just buy a t-shirt and that will mean the world to me. So.
Oh, well, we always appreciate the time, Colt. Me and Wei, we are going to push to get Colt Cabana across Canada on the Fight Network with Marty DeRosa. So we're pushing for it, Colt.
I don't know. Like, you know, I know the traction that I have and the 100,000 Twitter followers. And like, I know the people that get me, but unfortunately the ones that don't know, they're just like, huh? Colt? What? Oh, he's just some dude. And I'm just like, ah, no. So we got to turn those suits, you know?
It's the levels you have to navigate in this world, Colt.
Yeah.
But thanks as always. The DVD, if you guys have not picked it up yet, it is on sale now everywhere, Amazon, WWE.com. An excellent DVD, and I would be saying this if Colt was not on the line. So, Colt, thank you so much for your time. We wish you all the best, and always appreciate when you make time for me and the Tinger here.
Yeah, of course. Hey, one thing before I leave.
Sure.
I just because I went and picked up this check. So I got an acting agent, and like I got in this commercial for Old Navy. I don't know if it played up there, but I was in it for 3 seconds, and I've made more money in that than I have in anything I've ever done in professional wrestling.
For an Old Navy spot, wow!
3 seconds, and I was under a football mask. Like you couldn't even see my face.
Oh wow! I've got to see this. I had not heard of this.
So yeah, you can YouTube that on Old Navy. Mike Ditka. He's the coach. So you might not be seeing a lot of me in wrestling anymore, as I might be a professional Old Navy commercial background guy.
Oh, that's fantastic. That is a segue few have been able to make from professional wrestling. You will be the first.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
So a big thank you to Colt Cabana. Once again, you can head on over to welovecolt.com and coltmerch.com to catch more with him. So very generous with his time there joining us on this this marathon podcast way. I don't know if Colt will get through this whole one.
Probably not.
It's a long one.
it's a bit long.
We are now going to head into your record-setting feedback here for the final 2 hours of this podcast. I think this is the most feedback we've ever gotten, Wei.
Yeah, definitely.
We also did post this earlier than we usually do.
Okay.
Because we did want to take some questions for Colt, but now we're going to get into your thoughts here. We're going to get through as many as we can here, but we're going to try not to be redundant with feedback here, but let's kick things off with Andrew Sheehy. Great choice for a review this week. Punk's DVD is the best one they've done since the Bret Hart disc back from 2005. The story of Punk's career in the indie circuit and promotions like Mid-South and Ring of Honor was done effectively. The thing that caught my eye was that he was adopted by someone named Shay.
Chez,
that's it. I didn't know until now that he moved out of his parents' home at a young age.
And he wasn't adopted by her. That was
no,
his
that
friend.
Was his friend. And anyway, some creative recap here. The interviews with Cabana, the lead singer of Rancid, several WWE wrestlers like Kofi Kingston, The Miz, Daniel Bryan, Cassius Ohno, John Cena, and others were compelling and worth watching. The straight edge leader's creative input makes this a must buy for all wrestling fans. 10 out of 10.
Tanis Sirwai says, best DVD of the year. The documentary part of the set was excellent in letting the viewers get in the mind of Punk and what life experiences and the people in it that made him the person he is today. Here's a guy who knew his worth and made the higher-ups know it through his hard work, dedication, and speaking his mind. This guy is a perfect example of not trying to be a character, but just being himself. CM Punk is Phil Brooks and vice versa, with no blurred lines in between. As much enjoyment as I got out of the documentary part of the set, the only problem was... I had was with the matches. After all the talk of how Punk loved his matches with Colt Cabana in IWA and his matches in ROH with Samoa Joe, I would assume that one or two matches from that time period would be on the disc since they already used some of that stock footage. Other than that, I give it a 1,000 out of 1,000, and it is a must-buy for any wrestling fan. Well, as we mentioned, I have a hard time thinking that they would allow them to incorporate full matches on this DVD, and as John said, it would take up a lot of time on this disc.
We go to Louis from Montreal. It has been said before, but I agree that the feel of that of the DVD was unlike any other WWE DVD released in the past. It was great to hear from Joey Matthews. I always loved him in ECW with Christian York. I really liked hearing personal stories like Punk buying Matthews' house for him. I would have liked to have had a few shoot interviews with some of the people who wanted to keep Punk down. I liked having Hayes and Heyman stick up for him on the DVD, but having negative interviews to balance him out would have really made the DVD different. 9 out of 10. I thought Hayes represented that counter-argument and the devil's advocate.
And are you really going to get somebody who's speaking honestly to bury CM Punk on his own DVD?
You're also putting yourself in a position where it's like, now is almost like after the fact. The guy's made it. You're also talking to an audience that loves this guy. Mm-hmm. You almost sound foolish. Yeah. And I could see them, well, Hayes, you can take this one.
All right. Our next reviewer says, I spent much of my birthday driving around Vaughan, Ontario, trying to find this thing, but I couldn't. I ordered it online instead. Then entered CM Punk into a YouTube... Oh, we won't mention all that. Oh, the documentary was an interesting behind-the-scenes look at how a wrestler develops his trade and how the differing promotions handle development. The image of a heavy CM Punk was freaky. CM Puff is more like it. I give it a 9 out of 10. Still feel the documentary was a bit of an ego boost. Otherwise, very worth multiple viewings.
I don't know if you're going to have too many personality-driven DVDs that are going to be downers. We're going to present the...
Not true.
The Marty Jannetty story, presented by WWE.
Well, what I mean is Beyond the Mat certainly wasn't an ego boost for anybody.
Well, that was also kind of an outsider's view inside a world. This is the internal presentation of one of their own characters. I mean, it's
an autobiography.
Yeah. Paul Ellett from the UK. This DVD is excellent, with a lot of honesty and those that matter, and some great extras, including match selection. Orton's DVD was really cringeworthy at times when it did everything to keep kayfab. But often, this one doesn't feel like a wrestling DVD, and in a good way. I'm surprised just how much attention was given to Chris Hero and Colt Cabana in Punk's pre-WWE career. The list of talking heads was spot on, too, with the likes of Joey Mercury over Brooklyn Brawler. The first half is a great compliment to the Wrestling Road Diaries and sums up the indie wrestling scene in the first decade of the 21st century very well. That was a credit with Orton. It was like they had his real-life story and all his problems and drug issues, which was great, but then it was juxtaposed with this build-up, interestingly enough, to the Punk match at WrestleMania that year, which was all done as if it was like this shoot match they were having.
Mm-hmm. Danny Hernandez says, a side note on the story of the story of CM Punk's life is similar to the story of the Michael Oher from The Blind Side. You heard of Michael Oher?
Yes.
Oh, you have?
Well, I know the movie Blind Side. I assume that's what he's talking about.
I've never heard
of it. I haven't seen the movie either.
So really good production. Three things that stood out. One, him buying Joey Mercury's house. Never heard that story, and if it is true, that's a pretty selfless thing to do. I know I sure don't go around buying things for six figures for people. Two, Bryan Danielson's comment about people hiding out backstage so they didn't have to work superstars. Considering all the reports you get of unhappy talent, those not being used and so on, I wouldn't have figured anyone would willingly try to not be on TV. Three, Punk's calls for his infamous pipe bomb, a promo, not a shoot, a promo. Yes, we knew that while all of that was most of his real feelings, it was always a promo. Some people seem to ignore the fact that WWE/Vince allowed him to say all that, and while I'm not going to go back and check, I feel like Punk always acknowledged it as a shoot before this DVD.
I don't think anyone ever had an idea that this guy commandeered the show.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, guys. This is...
Well, certainly, right after it happened, a lot of people were questioning whether or not this guy, you know, went off script.
Yeah. Ooh. It's such a bullshit argument, too, because it's like... No one cares the fact that, yes, this is part of the show, but you know what? It had so much attachment to reality that people accepted it. Mm-hmm. It was like there was still that specialness to it because it's like, okay, yes, this is building up a pay-per-view, but at the same time, he's speaking a lot of things that I'm sure had valid criticism that was festering within him, and it worked.
I think it goes back to, you know, what they did with the first Summer of Punk that in ROH is just taking the expectations of the fans, thinking that they know what they know, and basically turning it around to use against them.
We go to David C. here. This DVD was true to its name, best in the world. Loved the presentation of his story, and the shots for all of the interviews truly made me feel as if I was watching something different than every other documentary that WWE has put onto the market. Only real complaint I had was the segment at the comic book convention where the microphone was improperly placed, giving a more distorted sound to his comments. As a college communications major, even I know how to properly place a mic on someone to avoid that issue. Besides that, no complaints, and I can only hope we see more DVDs like this in the future. Hopefully Daniel Bryan, yes, won't be too far away. 9 out of 10. Way, as someone that you're always quick to fix my mic positioning, was this something that you noticed? Because I did notice the distortion at times.
Yeah, it just seemed like something happened. You know, listen, when you're in the field, shit happens. It's very rare that
we've worked at places where the person hasn't even mic'd the interview subject, and then we're live on the air.
Yes, we have. Oh, yes, we have.
So, come on, they're at least halfway there. The mic was on.
Well, that was a good show. You know, shit happens. This was a small portion of it.
I enjoyed this, where he gave the whole backstory of, like, the comic influence and stuff. And
yeah.
I am not as much into comics as you are.
It was a thrill for me seeing him flip through all those books and seeing him meet Stan Lee. Stan Lee coming up to CM Punk.
Stan Lee with a cameo.
He's got a cameo in every movie, it seems.
Fantastic.
But you know, it's very clear that CM Punk somewhat sees himself as a superhero, and perhaps this is part of the reason why he's so contentious with so many people he meets. We go to Brett in Vancouver, who says, I thought the documentary portion was great. That's all I've seen so far. I like that they didn't slant this one. Would have been nice to hear what Triple H and Taker really thought of this guy when he came in, or better yet, that they probably just completely ignored him. I'm not a Punk mark by any stretch. I do find his personality just to be a little arrogant and maybe preachy, but he's very good, and I think he deserves the spot he's carved out for himself. He did it his way, which is great. I would have liked to hear more about certain things. For one, he kind of crapped on The Miz and sounded just jealous, but it was glossed over pretty quickly and then never addressed even when Miz was being interviewed.
I would have liked to have heard Miz's response to Punk's comments.
Yeah,
it did seem like Miz sat down, not aware of what was going to be leading into his reactions.
Mm-hmm.
G. Hall writes, I thought the documentary was pretty solid, but have a few complaints worth noting. Lars Fredriksson is not the lead singer of Rancid. The fellow who embodies that moniker is Tim Armstrong, who started Rancid after his band Operation Ivy folded. The latter band was noted in the documentary.
Who called him the lead singer? Did they in the documentary? They called him
the lead
singer?
I
guess so. Oh, okay.
Lars joined after Rancid's first full album release and does often take the helm of lead vocal duties. However, most in the know acknowledge Tim as the band's frontman. You've got to wonder if there's a parallel of 1 and 1A between those two singers and John Cena, CM Punk, respectively. Anyway, furthermore, was there any one match that was a question he had for Colt.
We go to Ryan from Vancouver, who says, this DVD was brilliantly done. Definitely in the top 5 DVDs ever made by the WWE. Only 2 minor problems. I wish there were some indie matches on the 3-disc set, and I feel like documentaries like these should be done when a wrestler's career is over. Punk is still in his prime, and there's still so much of his career left. I don't understand why they do career retrospective DVDs in the middle of a guy's career.
Come on, guys.
But overall,
are we being serious here?
A phenomenal DVD. Yeah.
This is not like the Baseball Hall of Fame or something. It's a DVD where you are trying to make money off of a guy while he's at his peak. Come on. Not a valid criticism.
Yeah.
Richard Elsie.
This was easily my most anticipated release since the rise and fall of ECW, and it did not disappoint. The Blu-ray dropped through my door the day of the release, and seeing how excited I was, my punk-loathing wife was kind enough to sit and eat dinner in the other room while I watched the documentary in its entirety. The shift in presentation for WWE's documentaries of late have been great, moving away from the somewhat stock clip/interview/clip format and onto something a little more distinct and personal. This approach suited punk perfectly, from the soundtrack to the use of ROH and IWA Mid-South footage. It didn't feel like your usual WWE produced and packaged release. The choice of Talking Heads was a breath of fresh air, with the one story of Mercury's being very touching and showing the good-natured side of punk to all his naysayers. What shocked me most, though, was the rather liberal attitude to criticizing the WWE and its creative process. At one point, punk blatantly buries the choice of The Miz when recounting the WrestleMania 27 main event. Revisiting the nuclear heat the straight-edge society received during its run was also great, although not needed. The admission that they were going for the whole Jesus and the Disciples vibe was fun. Lastly, the match selection was strong, with his matches against Cena and Bryan at Money in the Bank and Over the Limit respectively being the highlights, and he gives us a 10 out of 10.
We go to Michael, who says, I can honestly say, Michael G. from the outer reaches of purgatory. Okay, there we go. I can honestly say that I have been patiently waiting for the release of this since word came out that they were making one, and it delivers on all levels. This is probably one of, if not the best one of these movies that the WWF/E has made. There is a lot of the development process exposed in the film with interview segments with Triple H, Michael Hayes, and Heyman himself. They are all candid and very open with their thoughts on punk at varying stages in this early WWF/E career, and what really set him back. If you're at all a fan of how the business works and how very political and brutal it can be, if you are, yes. And for John Pollock,
here's a question for
you, John. Yeah, are you still a wrestling fan, John, or is this more of a job for you now?
Oh, why is he only asking me that? I guess I convey a very jaded view, as opposed to you.
Maybe he just cares about what you have to say.
Of course, I definitely enjoy watching wrestling. I love quality stuff, and mm-hmm. I don't like shitty stuff.
Yeah.
Much like anything, I'm still a fan of Dexter, despite not liking this season at all. I'm a fan of the overall product, but there are episodes I fucking hate. And with wrestling, I just watched an excellent New Japan pay-per-view last week, and I watched an average TNA pay-per-view on Sunday. And I think that just because you don't like maybe a pay-per-view, doesn't mean you hate wrestling.
Not at all.
Yes. But to that point, if I didn't have to do this, I would certainly watch less than I do.
Yeah.
SmackDown would be cut instantly from my viewing, my weekly viewing. I sometimes wonder why I watch it now. Do you ever watch SmackDown?
Rarely.
We go to Doc Scott from the UK. Hey guys, it's 1:30 a.m. Saturday morning, and I've just finished watching the Punk documentary. All I can say is, wow, it's not only the best wrestling DVD I've watched, but one of the best documentaries I've watched. They say the best stories are true stories, and this is absolutely the case. I love Punk's story from start to finish for it to show and prove that hard work, staying true to yourself, and never selling out can overcome the odds. It's very uplifting. I'm 41 years old and been a wrestling fan since the late 80s. I zoned out mid-2004 and only got back into the product after Punk's shoot. I now enjoy wrestling as much as I did when I was younger, helped by your excellent podcast, of course, and also the fact that I watch it with my 9-year-old son. So to CM Punk, I say thank you for bringing me back to something I love and to something I now share and enjoy with my son. 9.5 out of 10.
Wow.
Bringing him and his son even closer together, and it still doesn't get a perfect score.
Hey, come on.
It's a point five. Where the fuck was those IWA matches?
George C. says, I thought the documentary was very well done. I really enjoyed the stories of Punk's early years in the Indies and ROH, but was a little disappointed that there was no mention of his time in TNA, and particularly his blow-up fight with Teddy Hart. Overall, some excellent insight
and
really good storytelling.
Why would you include that? Why would you include that? And really, he did nothing of note in TNA. Did a few tag matches with Ace Steel.
I'm surprised Teddy Hart wasn't on this.
I'm stunned he wasn't. Jordan Smith writes, I was incredibly surprised with how honest they were in this DVD. We got an inside look behind the scenes of the WWE and went as far to admit that Punk didn't fit their image of a superstar. I find the behind the scenes of the WWE fascinating and very much getting a behind the scenes look at the politics. I think the WWE was very smart with the way they produced this DVD by targeting it to our audience. They were smart enough to know that people most likely to buy a CM Punk DVD were fans like us on wrestling message boards who are already sort of familiar with the way WWE works behind the scenes and the way they look at indie wrestling. wrestlers. I think if they did a kayfabe DVD, I think this DVD would have been a WCW 2000 level disaster. I also enjoyed the interview from Michael Hayes, who gave us great insight into how the company looked at Punk when he first started. It was great to hear from Cabana, Heyman, and I really enjoyed hearing from Joey Mercury as he talked about his and Punk's relationship on the road. It was almost like the startup to a joke. A straight edge guy and a drug addict walk into a room, etc. In all seriousness, I was very happy with how honest Punk was about his interesting upbringing. I guarantee anyone who is a fan of Punk's or has interest in the backstage politics in the Fed to check out this documentary. 2 hours well spent for any true wrestling fan. I give this documentary, again, a 9.5 out of 10. Would have been a 10 if we got some of his indie matches as well on the DVD, but there are some great matches on there too. But I did enjoy some of the ROH footage they used in the documentary.
Oh, you guys. You guys. What if ROH did a documentary on CM Punk themselves and asked for the WWE to put their Money in the Bank match with John Cena on, to put the promo on? Do you think that would happen?
Well, there's more to gain of ROH, you know, getting exposure to the WWE audience than vice versa. WWE has nothing to gain getting it to them.
And they had plenty of exposure in this documentary, but to give out these full matches, I don't think the WWE would want to. That's not true. They would pay for it, but come on, this is ROH's life.
I don't think WWE just. I don't think ROH would have put up much of a stink if they offered the money to put a match on their DVD. I mean, it's. I know. I don't think it was. It was probably just something, whether it be a timing issue or they weren't going to put it on. You got your clips.
Christian Small says, the first day I could pre-order this DVD, I did. I even went the extra mile and got the Blu-ray. I'm glad I did, as it was simply fantastic. I think everyone who was interviewed added a lot, and there were no random Brooklyn Brawler editions like we get with a lot of these DVDs. One thing I found random was at certain points they would just bring up a new subject. One second they're looking at Punk's career, and then talking about him cutting out meat from his diet, but they did tie it back well, I think, and it didn't ruin my viewing. I think they're just trying. This DVD, they're trying a lot of different, I guess, storytelling devices. Then they were using those setting changes as sort of a transition, as breaks between their different subjects. So,
what did you think of the Against Me music video?
It sucked. It was terrible. You're talking about the bonus music.
Yeah, it was
video.
On the bonus.
Yeah, that was lame. But the best part of the bonus features is that Lars Fredriksson interview.
Yeah, yeah.
Where he talks about, well, Punk was, you know, in the middle of his contract dispute and him not knowing if he wanted to sign back up or not, he had this talk with Lars, and Lars just goes into this story about when Johnny Ramone was set to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, and it's a great story. So definitely check that out if you get the DVD. Well, okay, so he says, one person I would have liked to have seen interview was Luke Gallows. I think he could have added a lot. The extras were all great, the bonus stories were good, and I found the original plan for December to Dismember to be something I wish had happened. As for the matches, some of my favorites were on there. His match with Morrison I still love, and everything from his famous promo, one shows why he is the best in the world. Simply put, this is the only WWE DVD I've bought in some time, and only did it... Okay. Overall, a 10 out of 10 for me.
We go to Ahmad, but everyone's raved about this DVD, so I won't be redundant. I wish they touched upon the Albatrosses that were the Big Show feud and New Nexus. It's no secret I'm a Punk guy. I will say that Punk is the reason why I still watch. I stopped watching wrestling from 2001 to 2008 due to lack of interest in the product. After returning home from a year of dorming at college, I found myself bored on weeknights. I turned on Raw and still had no interest in wrestling outside of Shawn Michaels. Well, then this guy CM Punk won this Money in the Bank briefcase. He was a super vanilla babyface, which wasn't something I ever cared for, but there was something about his look, music, and in-ring style. Once he turned heel, I found the next pro wrestler that defined why I love pro wrestling. For my childhood, it was Shawn, and for my young adulthood, it's Punk. And here is some Raw photoshopping with the best cover we have ever had with Wei Ting as CM Punk. This is by far my favorite fan-created art we have ever received.
Well, thank you, Ahmad.
I want to make this my Twitter photo, but I feel a topless Wei Ting as my Twitter profile pic would just be too weird. It should be yours, though.
maybe. It would be weird.
Would you evolve from the clips?
It would be weird for me, too.
Yeah, I guess so.
A lot of people wouldn't know.
This looks so great. Like, look how the forehead morphs into your face.
Ahmad did a fantastic job, as he always does with art.
So good.
What I didn't even notice until somebody else pointed it out was on my knuckles.
Dang.
Yeah. The attention to detail is just terrific.
So thank you, Lamont, for the album art, which you see on your iPod right now.
Amazing.
We go to Alex, who says, "Hey guys, I watched the CM Punk DVD and have to say that all the praise from everyone over its release is not nearly high enough. This is clearly one of the best DVDs the WWE has ever put out and shows how the WWE's great production value can enhance a great story. It actually seems like a crew followed Punk around for months, just shooting him at different areas, so it feels like Punk is not quickly glossing over parts of his story just to finish the interview. If I had to nitpick something, it would be... first, the exclusion of Vinnie Mac himself, especially during the discussion of Punk leaving at Money in the Bank. Punk says he didn't sign until just after the pay-per-view started, so it would have been nice to hear what Vince had to say, to hear Vince say that what plans he had, if a deal would not have been reached, or how close he got to actually just saying Punk was not worth resigning. The other thing would be the inclusion of John Cena, who came off as someone who still didn't think Punk was good enough to be a main eventer and that he was overhyped. I guess a former prototype and sometimes rap star never believed someone could get over without having to have a gimmick put on him. In any case, like I said, I am nitpicking, and this is without a doubt the best WWE DVD that I have seen in a long time."
We go on over to Matt and Sophie from Bristol in the UK. I'm always amazed by how many UK listeners we get.
Yes.
"Long-time listener, first-time feedbacker. As living in the UK, it's a nightmare trying to time feedback to Raw and Impact." Oh, yes, we apologize. It must be 5 hours ahead. That's terrible. "Luckily, I've managed to catch the Punk DVD, and it is definitely worth a purchase for wrestling fans of pretty much any level. It's quite unusual to get a wrestling documentary with the production values this one has, let alone one that has an official WWE release. I was glad that this one didn't go down the kayfabe route that the Randy Orton DVD did. I'm surprised WWE doesn't do more DVDs showing the planning that goes behind some of their events, as it is always interesting hearing guys like Punk explain how they came up with certain spots. Punk comes across pretty much as the guy we all know him as. By no means perfect, but with an extremely determined and passionate nature when it comes to the wrestling business. His story was actually much more interesting than I was expecting, and that is coming from someone who knows a little bit about Punk's background. It's worth a place on any fan's DVD collection alongside the likes of Beyond the Mat. For what it's worth, my wife is only a casual wrestling fan, and she really enjoyed watching it, so I think it is one of those rare DVDs that can be enjoyed universally and not just for fans of wrestling. We jointly give this a 9 out of 10.
Well, that's good. I'd like to hear more couples reviews on this
show. Yeah, yeah. Combo reviewing parties.
Tom Ketwig from Boise, Idaho, who says, "I just finished watching this Blu-ray version of this documentary, and it is one of the best that they have done in a long time." And he teaches us how to access an Easter egg. If you click left a couple times on the main chapter of the documentary, you hear a story about CM Punk talking about Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Are you a big fan of Easter eggs?
I hate them. I think it's so stupid.
Oh, I think it's cool.
That's great. It just feels like such a relic from when DVDs first came out. It's like, okay, it's been
Easter eggs
over a decade now. Are we still doing this?
Yeah, why not?
Still doing this.
"The only issues I had with the documentary is that I would have loved to have heard from Jeff Hardy, Samoa Joe, Mike Bucci, who was running WWE's development program at the time Punk was in OVW and who was a big fan of his, Gabe Sapolsky, and those in the WWE office like Arn and Stephanie, who were not fans of him at first. I also would have loved to have heard from either CM Punk or Tony Atlas talk about Tony's visit to OVW while Punk was there and talk about how Mr. Atlas was not a fan of Punk's taped hands due to the fact that OVW could not do a taped fist match. Also, how about a little bit more about Punk's jealousy over The Miz getting to face John Cena at WrestleMania 27? The documentary does a pretty good job talking about how many of the times WWE blew it with Punk. Imagine after he won the WWE title at Money in the Bank, if he would have defended the WWE title at, say, Ring of Honor, New Japan, and various other independent companies throughout that summer. I give the documentary a 9 out of 10 due to not being able to interview the various people I mentioned for various reasons. The documentary is worth watching if it shows up on Netflix, or is a download on, say, Amazon or iTunes. I thought the match selection was pretty good. I won't beat a dead horse when it comes to not having any of his matches prior to being in WWE. I personally would have included the John Cena entrance from WrestleMania 22, his match from the 2006 Survivor Series, his other Money in the Bank win at WrestleMania." He just goes on with all his favorite
That's what
matches.
He wanted in there?
Yeah.
Those were all included.
The 2006 match was there?
The Survivor Series? That's where he got the big chance. They showed that.
Oh, okay. Well, how about the Money in the Bank win at WrestleMania 25?
They showed that again.
How about the loser leaves WWE steel cage match versus Jeff Hardy from SmackDown?
That they did not show. That they did not show. They can't put everything in here. And they also had his WrestleMania 22. That was an extra. They had Cena discuss it too. He had no idea who Punk was.
Okay.
So, come on, guys. We go on. That Tony Atlas story, though, that was hilarious. Another part to that story is the fact that Tony Atlas was like, he said something, I'm paraphrasing, do you think you're ever going to get on WWE TV like this? And this was like a year after Punk had been called up and he was going back to train during the week. Man. So Tony Atlas not watching WWE programming. Kid Canada. I didn't really follow Punk at all until he debuted in the new ECW, so it was awesome to see so much of his old history from Chicago to the IWA to ROH and even OVW. But what really made this DVD amazing was both how candid Punk was about his career, even kind of taking shots at guys like Morrison and The Miz, and how candid other guys were about Punk. Michael Hayes, Triple H, Cabana, Kofi, Daniel Bryan, and so on. But to me, the true MVP of this documentary was Heyman. That backstory from Heyman about what it was like trying to advocate for Punk and hearing the other side from Hayes and JR really did a good job at showing what Punk was battling against at the start of his career. Kudos to referencing key guys from his career like Brent Albright, Raven, and Samoa Joe. I love the DVD. Highly recommend it to any wrestling fan. Is it just me, or did Cena come across like kind of a dick throughout?
Yeah, a little bit.
But that is you know what? That was maybe his true feelings.
Maybe that was the intent.
The early Punk.
Well, maybe that was part of the intent of the editing as well, is to make Cena. Everybody knows Cena is going to be seen as the villain here. So maybe that was something you could chalk up to the editing. I mean, I'd like to watch a John Cena DVD and see how CM Punk is portrayed. Yeah. Probably pretty well. All right, we go to our next reviewer who says, on Friday afternoon, I called a Best Buy, and they said they had it in stock. So I went all the way up to the location to get it, and they didn't have it. So I went to a Future shop close by, and they didn't have it either. Neither did an HMV in the mall close to the stores. So I phoned another Best Buy, and they said they had it and put it on hold and told them I would be there tomorrow. So the next day, me and my dad went to the Best Buy, and I bought it. It even came with two CM Punk wristbands.
Oh, yes, of course.
Which is cool. Me and my dad watched the documentary part today, and we both thought it was really good. I like the special feature of the title in the fridge. I remember when he posted a pic of that on Twitter in July 2011. I never thought he was that exhausted and that he did that right after he got home from the match. The dog park was very good. My dad believes that Punk could be the one to end Undertaker's streak at WrestleMania. Like, if he beats him, then he would earn the respect he has been wanting.
Don't think that's happening. We go to Imran from Huddersfield. In surprise, surprise, the UK. In terms of WWE-produced documentaries, the CM Punk Best in the World documentary has to be up there with the best they've ever produced. It's a fantastic watch that really gives you great insight into who and what CM Punk is, where he comes from, and what motivates him. After watching it, it almost made me mad. It almost made me sad he's currently a heel, as this is a man who I would want to stand up and applaud every night he performs as a testament to what he has achieved in his career so far. The DVD did a good job of talking about his post-WWE days, and I imagine would be a very informative way of finding out about Punk's early career for the uninformed. Whilst the DVD is great, I do have a couple of minor criticisms of the documentary, however. Firstly, it often appears as if Punk was magically put into these positions where he would win the ECW title, or win the Money in the Bank, or win the championship. After every one of those events, it was more a case of Punk saying, well, they gave me this win, and I thought, no way are they giving me any more than this. But it would have been good to know who it was who gave him those titles, or who it was who believed in him after Paul Heyman was no longer a factor. The second minor gripe I had with the documentary was that I think it really missed a trick by not having Vince interviewed regarding the Money in the Bank 2011 pay-per-view. For such a huge saga/event in the company's recent history, it would have been interesting to hear Vinnie Mac's take on what happened and how his opinion on Punk perhaps changed throughout the scenario, and lastly, what convinced them it was the right decision to put the title on Punk at the end of the show. Those are just a few minor gripes, though. All in all, it's a fantastic documentary, and compiled with the standard matches these releases bring, it is a must-see for any wrestling fan and a must-have for any Punk fan.
Brandon Sears from Halifax, Nova Scotia. I watched the Blu-ray this past Friday night and really enjoyed it. There were parts where Punk came across as a bit of an asshole, but given the fact that he makes no excuses regarding his personal character, it's hard to hold that against him. At least he's honest. That being said, I couldn't have rolled my eyes any harder when he said that he felt sorry for people who didn't have tattoos, as it proves they do not believe in things as strongly as he does. Just because I choose not to decorate my body in both artwork and writing does not mean that my convictions are worth any less than yours. Great work, guys. Love the podcast. And long live the off-topic banter.
Yes. All right. We go to Bavin from New Jersey. I saw the DVD a couple of days ago, and it's one of the best WWE docs ever.
I've been a CM Punk guy ever since he debuted into the WWE during the whole ECW revival. I always felt he was underutilized because the powers that be didn't want him to become somebody that everyone was hyping him up to be. He should have been the man in ECW, but WWE had other plans. I mean, he had a competitive feud with Chavo Guerrero. Then he moves to SmackDown, but still was a bit player even though he won the world title. But until he turned heel on Jeff Hardy, and that's when he took off. And after that, the Straight Edge Society was great. Too bad it wasn't talked about much in the documentary. Oh yeah, that pop he got in Philadelphia in Survivor Series in 2006 when he overshadowed DX. Guess that didn't help him after that, only to get buried in a nice way for Triple H to duck that one and BS about it while he was one of the guys holding him back. Great DVD, over 9,000 run-on sentences. I would concur. Finish us off, Way.
Finally, from Turk. Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for the great podcast. I wasn't following what was going on in the E from 2006 to 2011, so it was nice to get updated on some of the things I missed through this DVD. I really like the Straight Edge Society stuff, particularly Punk's story about a woman calling him the devil and the funny montage with the word devil being repeated over and over again. I had to say something about Lars from Rancid. I was a big Rancid fan in my younger years, and I've always liked him, but he looks really stupid with that skank tattoo on his forehead. I know it's not actually referring to a woman of ill repute. It's referring to a form of dance related to music they play. In this context, the word gets used as a verb, i.e. skanking, but I don't think most people who see the tattoo would know that. It's just a very poor choice of tattoo and tattoo placement. He looks like someone forced him to get a humiliating word stamped on his head as part of a frat ritual or something. Back on topic, sorta. I love how the DVD ended with CM Punk spoofing the end of Ferris Bueller's Day Off when he comes out in a robe, acts surprised we're still there, and tells us to go home because it's over. He's clearly a very witty and clever man with a good taste in movies and music.
Was that what was being referred to as the Easter egg? Because that's how the DVD ends.
No, and I think he has a story about Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Okay.
If you click left a few times on the main menu.
All right. Before we get out of here, I did want to make mention one of the extras as well on the skull fracture. Insane.
Sorry, what was that story again?
Where he does him and Reckless Youth, they crack heads on an IWA show, and he continues on with the match, including he dives over the top rope with a somersault dive to the floor without padding on. And they show him using a chair to get to the back.
Yeah.
He had blood go into his spinal column. This was just gruesome, and they have Punk watch the match and tell us what's happening.
And
this was that to me was another extra worth watching if you've got a stomach for it.
Yeah. Not something I would ever try.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up our review of the CM Punk Best in the World DVD, obviously getting tons of praise from people. I want to thank Colt Cabana for stopping by to chat about his involvement as well as stuff that's going on with him and taking your questions. Going to wrap things up your way, but the reviews never stop. In fact, Louis from Montreal, he put together a graphic, did you know, of the thread. There are over 500 requests in that thing for future reviews. We could continue on for years and years and years and still not get all these reviews done.
Should we stop taking requests?
Like
maybe?
A decade of reviews is waiting for us.
I think that at that point it would start to become a job.
If you know you had to do another 10 years of these?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take it 1 week at a time. And next week, I was trying to think of what should we review, Wade? And we're going to be going into Hell in a Cell with Ryback challenging CM Punk for the WWE title in Atlanta, Georgia. And, you know, the Goldberg comparisons have been made since day one with one Ryan Reeves, a.k.a. Ryback. So I thought we would go back to July the 6th of 1998. Bill Goldberg challenging Hulk Hogan for the WCW title inside of the Georgia Dome in Atlanta. As a primer, so that we can raise expectations so high that are impossible to be met at Hell in a Cell. So we will guarantee letdown. So I thought we could review that next week, pending if we can find this show, because I cannot find it anywhere.
Somebody out there will be able to dig this up.
All right. So you down to review that?
Of course I am. WCW, always.
Nitro. This was the summer of 98. Hot period for wrestling. Even if WCW, the cracks were certainly forming. But we're going to check that out. Bill Goldberg and Hulk Hogan, hopefully next week if we can find this show. In the meantime, you can always check out liveaudiowrestling.com. Subscribe to Live Audio Wrestling on iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter, at Law Radio, at Way0937. And we do this Review Away podcast every single Wednesday if you are new to the show. And we appreciate any retweets out there.
Yeah. We also do reviews of Raw and TNA Impact.
Always lots of shows. Raw we do every late Monday night, and then Impact Friday morning, reviewing those shows.
And you can always leave your feedback like all 48 people have done for this particular podcast at lawradio.proboards.com.
That's it. So get us out of here, Way. What music can properly encapsulate these past few hours we've spent discussing one Phil Brooks?
Jesus, wow. That's a
lot of pressure. Lots of pressure.
Yeah, this was a very musical documentary in many ways.
Yes, music was a nice addition, more so than most WWE productions.
We got to go with CM Punk's old ROH theme. AFI. What's the name of that song?
I have no clue. Gonna end this one on a whimper. AFI CM Punk theme. Miseria Kintaire? I am butchering that.
That's it.
Well, how do you pronounce it? Do you know?
I have no idea.
All right, here we go with some AFI to cap off podcast. Man,
great conclusion.
Nice sprint, and then we just struggle through the finish.